Navigating truth in a world of lies. You are listening to the John Age Project.
Trust no one. Trust no one. Trust no one.
Thank you for joining us today on the Anomic Age. You found it. You're here. You have entered into the Anomic Age. And I am your humble host, John Age. So happy for you to be joining us today. We're coming to you proudly from Carolina Beach, North Carolina. Been waiting to say that for a while. So I'm happy to be here. We've been recording at a number of places. You wouldn't believe the you wouldn't believe the work that's gone into the program for the last month or so. So we're at a little bit more of a stable position maybe than we once were. We'll see. If not, we'll just move around again. It'll be all right. The show will keep rotating and coming to you from various different places around the world, around the state, around the county, at the very least. Either way, thank you for joining us today on the Anomic Age. I am your host, John Age. Please check out AnomicAge.com for all things me, all things Anomic Age, the guest links, the show links, the donation at the very bottom. You can donate directly there to Anomic Age from PayPal. So that'll be good. Please, I encourage you to do that. Also, you can go to paypal.me/Anomic Age and you can donate directly there too. So if you don't want to go to Twitter for some reason, which you can find it there, or you don't want to go to Anomic Age for some reason, if you just want to go directly to PayPal, that's cool. paypal.me/Anomic Age, please. The ship needs fuel to keep us sailing. Thank you for joining us, and feel free to donate if you will. As you might expect, we have a great guest today, or guests, I should say. We'll be joined by Alan Myers for perhaps our final segment with him for a little bit to discuss Fed Ed, the final few sections of that lovely publication. And we'll also be joined by Pamela Adams, who'll be talking all things about her research, her publications, and her website, thefactspaper.com. So hold on to your hats for all of our guests. It's going to be great. We'll get to hear some Fed Ed. We'll get to hear some facts papers. We'll cover a wealth of knowledge and information that you may not have yet availed yourself of. So please, stay tuned. But we're not going to segue yet. We're not going to Gillette into a separate episode of the program quite yet, because we've got a lot of news to talk about. We've got quite a lengthy show today, too, so I'll try to reel myself in and just give you, I hate to say the cliff notes, but a little bit of the broad strokes of what we got going on in the news. As usual, I didn't hit the usual news topics. If you want to hit the usual suspects in the news, feel free to check out another program, because those are the things that you're inundated with continuously all the time, to the point that you're banging your head in the corner, kind of akin to the end of that old Blair Witch Project thing, okay? So we don't want you to do that. We have far more disturbing things to talk about than the what have you with the Mueller investigation and who's getting, I don't know, fired, quitting, suspended, whatever. That's important. Make no mistake about it. But what we're delivering is quite important as well. And in case you missed it, for the last few episodes, we've been doing this sort of, I don't know what you want to call it, a time machine segment, where we just get into articles that you should have already heard. And perhaps you did, but perhaps you didn't. So if you didn't, we'll get you into some of that today. Here we go. This is coming from Tyler Durden, from, you guessed it, everyone's favorite, Zero Hedge. And the title of this piece is, "These False Flags Were Used to Start a War." I bet you If you're in the mainstream land, you're probably going, what? What are you talking about? False flag. That's not real. That's a conspiracy theory. Nah. Wake up and smell the coffee. This is coming from Tyler Durden, 09/05/2013. In case you missed it, here's a rundown. And these are all just events that were predicated on, you guessed it, say it with me, class, false flags. You guessed it. Let me sort of skip around. I'll hit some of my favorites, and then we might come back. The Spanish-American War, i.e., the sinking of the USS Maine off the coast of Cuba. If you've delved into propaganda a bit like myself, you know this one. You know the propaganda piece is the hell with Maine. Sorry, Maine. I didn't mean that. Remember the Maine, the hell with Spain. That was one of the big propaganda leaflets of the time. And the push and the impetus of this false flag, of course, was to get us into a conflict with 1859, the sinking of the USS Maine on February 15th in Havana Harbor was initially thought to be caused by external mine explosions under the ship. The belief roused anti-Spanish sentiments in the United States and helped catalyze the Spanish-American War. But guess what? It was all a sham. Yeah, since then, we found out that the explosives, the incendiary devices, were not external, they were internal. How strange. So you mean it wasn't a mine put out there by the Spaniards? No. It was an internal explosive device? And if you go on, it really gets into this, gives the names, gives the information, and it gives you the rundown saying, not so much. It was most likely a false flag. Perpetrated by, I don't know, the primary arbiters of false flags, the United States. Of course. Let's move on. So, just so the U.S. doesn't feel alone, the Reichstag fire was an arson attack on the Reichstag building in Berlin on 27 February 1933. The fire started in the session chamber. And by the time the police and the firemen arrived, the main chamber of deputies was engulfed in flames. The fire was used as evidence by the Nazis that the communists were beginning a plot against the German government. On and on and on and on. Basically, it turns out that it was two mentally handicapped people that were put in place to start the fire and to take the rap. So that the Nazis would have the proverbial ammunition that they needed to move forward with their plans. We're talking about 1933 here. So all know what the Nazi party did soon after that. They began invading other countries all around them, right? Poland? Yeah, all that stuff. All kinds of fun and benevolent love brought to you by the Socialist Party known as the Nazis. Well, that's no big deal, right? I can't think. When have we seen a mentally handicapped person used to pull off a false flag to galvanize the populace around an event? Let me think. Well, we've had the Aurora shooting. We've had the other shooting and the other shooting and the other shooting and the other shooting and the other shooting. Wow, most of them were perpetrated by people that would be deemed unstable or ill, huh? Oh, well, it can't be anything. I'm sure it's just a coincidence, right? What else we got here? All kinds of goodies, right? The Gulf of Tonkin incident. That's the Tonkin Gulf out there, right out there from Vietnam. Let's read a little about this. The Gulf of Tonkin incident, or the USS Maddox incident, is the name given to two separate confrontations involving North Vietnam and the United States in the waters of the Gulf of Tonkin. The first event occurred on August 2nd, 1964, between the destroyer USS Maddox and 3 North Vietnamese naval torpedo boats. On and on and on. Bottom line is, this has been revealed even in mainline history to be a complete sham. Never happened. False flag to the fullest. But this is the lovely incident that got us in the Vietnam War. Well, how do they used to term it? The Vietnam conflict? They didn't want to term it as a war because it was, of course, another unconstitutional event. Much like the Korean War, the Gulf War, and every single war ever since World War II. No congressional approval. We just go out and do these conflicts or these humanitarian efforts. But make no mistake about it, the Gulf of Tonkin thing was a complete and utter sham. It's not on here, but it should be. The Pearl Harbor attacks. Yeah, Truman knew that the Pearl Harbor attacks were coming. They did everything to fan the flames of the Vietnamese to get them to attack us so we could get into World War II. But yeah, I mean, there's ample evidence. I can't recall the gentleman's name. He's written a book and a lot of articles and pieces about this. Basically just uncovering that, yeah, Truman had the speech written before the attack even occurred, which was, you know, he was going to go out there and do his, I want to say George Bush impersonation, but I guess Georgie Porgy was imitating old Truman, perhaps. I don't know. Anyway, he was doing his version of shock and awe. We're going to go get him. Yeah, we knew about him coming, but that's okay. Forget about it. Now we're going to go get him. I remember reading this, and I've touched on this in another episode. Where I remember a weekly reader when I was in first grade, which was a few decades ago. But a weekly reader used to be this actual little, like a 2-3 page periodical that you would get in elementary school, or at least my school did. And the weekly reader covered various events and news bits and bobs and so forth and so on. But one of the things that I remember was Pearl Harbor. And it discussed the attacks from the perspective of, I don't know the proper words for what this gentleman may have been within the U.S. Navy. But he was basically on watch, on patrol. And he was a radio gentleman, I believe. He was able to radio in and say, hey, we got planes coming in hot. You might want to check this out. Anyway, regardless of this gentleman's MOS, he was seeing the planes coming in. He had the radio, and he was contacting the various people in the bases that he needed to contact, saying, hey, we got Japanese planes coming in hot. Can you scramble some jets? Can we get some support here? Or there's going to be a problem, right? And if you remember back, this rings very true to what we saw during the 9/11 thing, where you heard a very similar tale, where we got military in D.C., and they're talking to the vice president and going, hey, we got a plane coming in to D.C. Anyone with a brain knows for a fact that that was a missile, but we'll pretend that that narrative is true, if you're complete ignoramus. But he was sitting there talking to the vice president saying, hey, we got a plane coming in. We got X amount of time before we can intercept and take this joker down. And he kept talking, hey, we got a plane coming in. Hey, we got... And finally, in his anger, the VP says, expletive. Basically, shut up. We want the planes to come in. We want to kill and arouse the American people into another silly war. And that's precisely what happened. So, again, if you look at history, it always repeats itself because the general public either doesn't know the history, doesn't care about the history, or just doesn't act upon the historical facts and knowledge that they have. So that was my segue into 9/11. I mean, 9/11 is another one that is a very obvious and apparent false flag, I believe, to anyone with even a modicum of gray matter in that hollowed out thing on top of their shoulders. You know, anyone who believes that this whole sham was pulled off and orchestrated by some guy on dialysis in a cave, I don't know what to say other than I have got some great oceanfront property. Yeah, for you in Arizona? Sure. I really don't know what to say. I mean, evidence, like mounting up. I would think the 9/11 evidence even surpasses the JFK assassination evidence, that this is a false flag. But I don't know what to say. You can also look at World War I with the sinking of the Lusitania. That got us into World War I, essentially, and the Germans were actually trying to put articles in American periodicals like the New York Times and so forth saying, hey, you might not want to get on those boats going from New York to Europe because we got German boats out there. They're going to blow them up because they're shipping munitions back and forth across the Atlantic. And the sinking of the Lusitania was the catalyst again to get us into World War I. The general public just heard, oh, those terrible Germans, they just sunk this passenger liner traveling the Atlantic. And then it came out, as you might expect, that they were in fact carrying munitions across the Atlantic. And that's why the Germans sank the boat. They warned the people, they're like, hey, if you put your hand on the stove, you're going to get burned. You're going to get burned if you put your hand on the stove. Hey, don't put your hand on the stove. But, hey, it's no big deal. It's just another false flag. It's just World War I, right? Just World War I. That's like the greatest war that they said, oh, we're never going to do this again. Too many people died, and we'll wait a couple years, and then we'll hit you with that false flag in Japan, and we'll roll you right into World War II. Then we'll play around in Korea for a while and have some more of our American people killed, maimed, and otherwise. Then we'll give you a break for a few years. We'll kill JFK. We'll roll in the one of the people behind the assassination, a racist, an all-around good guy, LBJ. And then we'll roll you right into Vietnam for some more years. Then we'll give you a break, and then we'll have some oil problems, of course, orchestrated by the same people that you might expect. The OPECs and the usual suspects, where we had this conflict in the late 70s and the gas shortages, quote-unquote, and Jimmy Carter, and oh, now we got the Mujahideen, and now we got Russians in the Middle East, and we've got to go in there and quell that, and ho-hum, now we're going back to the Middle East in the 90s. Then we roll into the 9/11 false flag, and what do we got? 17, 15 years later, here we are again. Vietnam number two, except it's even longer. Whew, let me get off that soapbox for a minute. Whew, I'm taking a breath. God, grief, there's so much insanity going on. Speaking of insanity, let's roll into some more insanity. This is coming from Patch.com. FBI operation locates more than 200. Again, I want everyone to not just sort of look past the numbers here, because it's easy to do. Look past the numbers. Every time you read a big number, your brain kind of just cuts off, and you look past the numbers. Everyone does it, myself included. 200. Think about that. Put it in your brain. Sit there and visualize 200 children. Okay? 200 children. We're talking about multiple classes of children here. More than 200 missing, exploited children. From May 1st to May 24th, the FBI said 231 missing and or exploited children were located in Georgia. This is by John Barker, Patch Staff. We're looking at patch.com, P-A-T-C-H.com. Check it out here. This is coming from May 29th, 2019. Atlanta, an operation designed to combat child exploitation and make communities safer. Embrace. For children, heading into the summer months has produced results according to the FBI. Through the FBI's Operation Safe Summer, or OSS. Nice acronyms. The Bureau reported there were 231 missing and or exploited children located from May 1st to May 24th in Georgia. Good night, nurse. We're not even talking about a full month. This is not even 30 days here. The end of the operation coincided with National Missing Children's Day on May 25th. Hey, rather than coinciding with this day, why don't you just continue this operation and help more children? I digress. The FBI Atlanta field office announced the results recently of OSS, a collaborative effort by 27 local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies led by the FBI's Metro Atlanta Child Exploitation and Human Trafficking Match Task Force. According to the National Center for Missing Exploited Children, NCMEC, good grief. In 2018, more than 23,500 runaways were reported to NCMEC. And 1 in 7 were likely victims of child trafficking. Good night. It just goes on and on. I mean, it's a great article as far as just giving you the broad strokes of what's really going on. But if you pull back a little bit, I think this will give you a little bit better idea of what's really going on, too. If you look into the work of Nancy Schaefer, she was an American politician and conservative activist who served in Georgia State Senate from 2004 until 2008. So why am I bringing up Nancy here? You're probably thinking to yourself, hey, this is some random representative from Georgia. What does this possibly have to do with anything that we're talking about regarding child trafficking?
Well, here's the truth.
Here it goes. Here it goes. Report of Georgia Senator Nancy Schaefer on CPS corruption. Yeah, here's the deal. She published a little thing in 2007, The Corrupt Business of Child Protective Services. The Corrupt Business of Child Protective Services. I want everyone to get this. Yeah, lean in close if you need to hear it again. The Corrupt Business of Child Protective Services. So where have you heard this before? Well, if you've heard it nowhere else, you've heard it on this program. Exactly. You've heard it on this program. You've heard me discuss the Franklin scandal, the Franklin cover-up. I mean, these were two books. Oh, man, they're over 20 years old now. There was a book. There was a accompanying HBO documentary that was set to be released on the basis of the book, but it got pulled. So you can get copies of the Franklin scandal now. You can order these off DVD. I've gotten one off, I think, eBay. I don't know if Amazon would carry it. But nonetheless, you can get copies of this documentary, which I highly recommend you watching. If you can't read the book, I understand. Time is valuable. So definitely watch that documentary. Don't watch it with underage people. Don't watch it with your children, is what I'm trying to get at here. It's disturbing. It should be disturbing. But it chronicles just this. It chronicles CPS, them procuring children for these politicians and other collective scum in the D.C. area. And again, a very old documentary. The bottom line here, The Corrupt Business of Child Protective Services by Nancy Schaefer, Senator, 50th District, Georgia, from 2007, it's giving you the same thing. We're talking 2007. The Franklin scandal was coming out in the early 90s, the Franklin cover-up, and it was chronicling events that were going on in the late 80s, early 90s with the Boys Town scandal. And then flash forward to 2007, you're seeing the same thing. Nancy Schaefer producing a document, not a documentary, not a book, but the same thing. Here's where it gets good. Or I hate to even say that. I'm being sardonic and using humor here, but if you're a member of Nancy Schaefer's family, this isn't good. And I apologize for that morose humor. It doesn't get good. It's just me trying to cope with the insanity that we live under constantly. Schaefer was found dead at her home in Turnerville, Georgia, on March 26, 2010. With a single gunshot wound to her back, along with her husband of 52 years. So they initially tried to roll this out as some sort of suicide, some sort of weird suicide pact or something. But again, I think you can dispel that. At least I can. I don't know what level everyone is listening at to this program. I'm assuming most people that are listening to this program have listened to it for a while. They're really on the level. They're keeping up with this information. They're probably doing their own research. And they know bleeping well this was not a murder-suicide, as this is what they tried to roll out as the initial cause of death here. I mean, anyone that's gotten into the research done by Gary Webb, and I have a whole notebook full of people that are just dead. Dead people that have 9 times out of 10 been murdered. It's almost always pawned off as a suicide. Almost always. Or it's some sort of some robbery gone wrong. Yeah, that's it. It's a robbery gone wrong. Or it's a suicide. That's always the two go-to elements to erase people and what they're trying to say. Because I don't know about you, but most people have never even heard of this lady. She was in the media a lot in the mid-2000s, obviously dying in 2010. So that was kind of the cutoff point. After that, everyone just kind of swept it under the rug, and just like everything else, it just all fell into this media menagerie of cyclical horsepucky that just says, okay, well, they're gone. Next, moving on. Oh, let's talk about some other scandal. Whoop, moving on. Let's talk about someone else. Whoop, moving on. Here's a hate crime. Whoop, moving on. It just goes on and on and on. And I don't know if everyone's connecting the dots, but I sincerely hope that you are. That's the point of this broadcast. That's why I'm here. I mean, I know people get tired of me harping on elements from the 90s, but I feel like it's cornerstone because I think the 90s were a lost decade. I don't understand how so many things that occurred in the 90s that affect us today just fell through the cracks. They just fell through the cracks. I don't get it. It bothers me. That's why I keep trying to harp on these events from the 90s. And make no mistake about it, we got a great guest coming up. Not in this episode. I've been pumping the brakes on releasing this interview, really because I want to dedicate the entirety of a show to this person's interview. I don't want it to get lost in anything else, because it's just that important. But make no mistake about it, in the next few weeks, I'll definitely be releasing the full interview I had with this gentleman. I'm even pulling his name right now. I'm not even going to tell you that. But he gets into a lot of the events of the 90s and a lot of his own personal experiences. And you guessed it, he is definitely someone in the know that was absolute boots on the ground involved in a lot of the things that occurred during the 90s. Then he paid a price for that. So we'll be talking to him more later on, I sincerely hope. But we'll definitely be releasing that interview in the coming weeks. Again, I've been pumping the brakes on. I've been trying to wait for that right moment, because I got so many guests and so much to talk about, and it's just sort of a backlog of information, and I don't want his interview to get lost in the shuffle or just sort of thrown out and not properly given its due. So we'll definitely do that in the coming weeks. Please make no mistake about it. So, last article, and then we'll move on into something a little bit, more disturbing, of course. This one is coming from, let me see, Quiletti, Quillette, Quillette.com. This is coming from May 29th, 2019. It's not your imagination. The journalists writing about Antifa are often their cheerleaders. Imagine that. These people are clearly racist. I mean, are you seriously sitting here saying that the mainstream media is bought and paid for? Are you trying to say that the CIA actually has operatives within all of mainstream media? And that they are actually telling these people what to print and what not to print and what spin to put on this and what quill to put on that? I can't believe that's true. It's so silly to me that we're in 2019 and there are still people that think that And this is I guess it's a Trumpism. I know it existed before him, but he really brought this term to the mainstream. Fake news. Fake news. I know John Rappaport's going, hey, I had no more fake news like 20 years ago. I know John Rappaport. But I think Trump really brought this to the masses because he was hitting all the public airwaves and hammering this fake news point home. And it's so disheartening that there's still people out there that find it hard to believe that the news is contrived on almost every level. I don't have the link pulled up, but you can do this on your own. I don't even know what to tell you to put in there. But if you YouTube this, you can find a just ungodly amount of information where it shows the same news broadcast from all over the United States and all over the globe as well. But we'll just focus on the U.S. because, hey, we live in the United States. But it shows the same news broadcast, and these teleprompter reading boobs are saying the same thing. And I'm not just sitting here saying, oh, they're paraphrasing, and they're saying something similar. No, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about they are saying the same thing. The same thing. They might throw a few pronouns here and there in between the words, but it's the exact same phrase. It's the exact same words in the exact same order. And if you can view that and sit there and tell me that the news is not fake, nor contrived, nor just completely controlled by whatever you want to call it. You want to say deep state, you want to say Illuminati, you want to say Keebler elves, whatever you want to call it that makes you sleep better at night, it's controlled. And if you can sit there and view that and somehow convince yourself and drink enough cognitive dissonance Kool-Aid to believe that it's not, hats off to you. That's all I can say. Let me get on with this article here. On February 1st, 2017, Milo Yiannopoulos was scheduled to give a talk about free speech at the University of California, Berkeley. Oh, boy. Yeah, that's just a bastion and haven of freedom and free speech, Milo. I can't believe you had any problem. But he was prevented from speaking by a group of 150 or so black-clad members of a then-obscure movement calling itself Antifa. That's right, Antifa. So this is no different than the Hitler brown shirts. Hey, it's the same logo and the same imagery and everything from the Hitler regime. It's a coincidence. Think nothing of it. The protesters caused $100,000 worth of damage to the campus and injured six people as they threw rocks and Molotov cocktails. 9 months later, again in Berkeley, an anti-Marxist rally descended into violence as approximately 100 masked Antifa members harassed journalists and beat rally organizers and attendees. It just goes on and on and on. And you know what really disgusts me? I'm using that word in place of what I really want to use. What really angers me here is if you look at the image that accompanies this article on the main page there, of course it's got a bunch of people dressed in black, and they got a little tattoo action going on. Oh, they got their black bandanas. And I guess they're thinking they're really spooky. I don't know. I'm wearing a black shirt now. I tend to wear black from time to time. Quite often. I've branched out in the last 5 to 10 years. So I now wear white, purple, and gray. But as a rule, I kind of wear a lot of black. And yeah, when I was a lot younger, I thought it was cool and some sort of, you know, punk hardcore thing to do. But at the same time, for me, it always served a very utilitarian function. Because it was black. And you couldn't really get stains on it. You could dress it up. You could dress it down. I sure as heck wasn't doing it to look like these imbeciles. But nonetheless, what really irks me when I'm looking at this picture is that I know the people in this picture are of the same ilk of people that I used to would classify as in the punk or hardcore scene. Because I'm looking at this image, and if you got this article pulled up, you're seeing the same one as me. And the main guy in the foreground there has clearly got a Gorilla Biscuits shirt, which is a hardcore band. It's turned inside out. It's black. And then two people back, there's a guy in a Drop Dead shirt, which is another punk hardcore band, whatever you want to call it. I would call them more, I guess, more punk than hardcore. They're not what I would really term as traditional hardcore. But nonetheless, two people obviously wearing band tees from that same sort of ilk, genre, however you want to really pigeonhole it. And it just really disturbs me. It disgusts me. Because when I was into this, and I realized maybe I was naive and didn't really catch on to the fact that all these people were communists in these bands and that they were singing about certainly very communist things. I see that now for what it is, which is why I really don't identify with really any of those people or any of that music at all. It's kind of hard for me to listen to it all sometimes, depending on the band, but I guess there's such a divide and such a dichotomy between what I thought it was about and what it is about, or what it has become. Perhaps that's the three sort of things that I'm sort of trying to inventory in my brain and make sense of. Because when I was into this, I thought it was really more about freedom. And it was about not coming down on certain people because of their beliefs. And it was about doing your own thing. I'm not going all the way to that do what thy wilt mess. I'm not going all the way to that. But I thought it was more about being independent, doing what you wanted to do, not persecuting other people. I mean, that's what I thought that ethos was about, which is the absolute antithesis of what it actually appears to be about now. Perhaps it was about all along. I don't know. I mean, when I was a kid and when I was younger, there weren't these roaming bands of idiots with their little idiotic masks on. I guess they think they're intimidating somebody by dressing in black. I'm no more intimidated by these clowns than I would be a parade of fluffy pink elephants. That would perhaps be more intimidating because they'd actually be masculine and strong, powerful elephants. Nonetheless, not the least bit intimidating, just a complete and utter sham and a fraud. Which goes back to what, you know, to bring it back to home or back to at least my state, what we saw at UNC last year with the destruction of Silent Sam and these violent protests with these insidious clowns. And you saw one of the people in the forefront of this was a professor. And he looked and was taking on the same tactics and attire of these lovely folks that you're seeing in this image here. It's just disheartening to see people acting like that and to have once identified with any sort of music or, dare I say, movement that has become what it is, or perhaps maybe it's just as revealed itself to be perhaps what it always was. I'm not sure. Nonetheless, it's sad and pathetic to me in 2019 as an adult man. But what can you do? I guess you got to keep on keeping on. And we'll keep on being vigilant, fighting the proverbial good fight. Non-violently, of course, and defending ourselves if we must. Despicable. That's all I can say. Despicable. But enough of that. Let's just roll into our guests, because I could keep talking about this at a long, long clip, but we're already 39 minutes into the program, and we haven't talked to a guest yet. We've got a lot of guests to talk to. We got two to be factual. So, without further delay, let's roll into our guests. If you stick around for just a mere matter of seconds, we will speak with our first guest, and then we'll roll into our second. Make sure you check out AnomicAge.com. Share that link with friends, family, loved ones, and enemies. If you haven't already done so, then why not? Stick around. We'll talk to our guest in a few. I'm pleased to welcome back to the program Mr. Alan Myers. Alan, in case you missed it, is a certified public accountant, a forensic accountant, and he'll be speaking with us today on his document FedEd. His specialty, and really what we're going to get into, the meat of the matter today, so to speak, is the creation and extinguishment of money. A lot of people might be listening to this going, what are you talking about, extinguishment of money? We're going to burn it? Are we going to throw it in the trash? Not so fast. We'll get into all that today as far as bookkeeping, ledgers, and really how this is done through the banking and Federal Reserve process today. Thank you once again for joining us, Alan.
Pleasure to be here, John. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Well, where could we begin? Or I guess we're sort of ending. We're coming to the end of the Fed Ed document. But in my opinion, it's kind of the good news of it. It's sort of the we can get out of this dark abyss and get into something better.
Absolutely. The whole push on this or the intent is that if you don't understand that a problem exists, you're very unlikely to even stumble onto understanding the need to solve it. Once you understand the true nature of a problem, that in itself helps a person figure out how to fix the problem. And once you understand what the fix is, and in this case it's actually relatively simple, then you can see into the future the benefits that are going to come with the fix. And today, as we've discussed earlier, if I told somebody we can make simple changes to the monetary system, and in doing so, we would ultimately eliminate inflation, federal income taxation, and the need for the federal government to borrow, people would think I'm a loon. I'm crazy. There's no way. This is the way it has to be. That's because they don't understand how the system really, really works. And that's what we're going to get into today, which is Module 16, how do banks and their Federal Reserve monetary system, as I like to say, lie to us, cheat on us, and steal from us.
That seems to be exactly what they're doing.
Other than that, it's a great thing. And to open, I would like to read this one quote, which to me really works with this module. The quote is, "In a time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act." George Orwell. Well, let's get revolutionary.
Please.
Let's talk about what's really happening. To understand the basics of banking. So when I talk about monetary system education, you don't need to have a PhD in economics. You don't need to be a Wall Streeter, big time investor. This is just how, as you said in the opening, how money is created and how it's extinguished, how it comes into existence, how it goes out of existence. And to understand this, all one must know and understand is simple, basic, ordinary, everyday bookkeeping. Because all of banking eventually comes down to bookkeeping. To get a financial transaction, in essence, entered into the general ledger, the accounting system of a bank. There's only one way to do it. You have to post what are called journal entries. Now, a journal entry, and the really nice thing about this process is that, and you can ask any bookkeeper, accountant, CPA, if you understand the financial transaction, can you write the journal entry? The answer is yes. Do you have to be present when the transaction happens? The answer is no. You just have to understand it to write the proper journal entry. And every journal entry has, and people are probably familiar with these terms, but they have specific meanings in bookkeeping. Debit and credit. Now there are, again, this is all background information to understand the journal entries we're going to talk about today. There are five basic types of accounts in a general ledger. Assets, liabilities, equity, they're on the balance sheet. Income and expenses, they're on the income statement. Those are the five basic accounts in all of accounting.
Okay.
Now, debits and credits have different effects. For assets and expenses, debits will increase the balance in the account, which is another way of saying credits will decrease. On the other hand, liabilities, equity, and income, credits increase their balances and debits decrease their balances. It's just background information, and it's actually very easy to see and understand this in a little spreadsheet graph. Bottom line is, every journal entry must have at least one debit and one credit. You could have one debit and two credits. You could have two debits and one credit, but you have to have at least one of each, and the total debt dollar amount of debits must equal the total dollar amounts of the credits. Once you have that, you hit enter, it goes into the system, the journal entry is posted, and this is how banking happens.
I like it.
Does that make sense so far?
Yeah, I mean, my little brain's connecting it back to those like fundamental exchange network things, like we talked about a few episodes ago, whether you're exchanging coca beans or whether you're exchanging baseball cards, there's always going to be that in and out flow of exchange. So whether, you know, whether or not it's our U.S. dollar or gold coins or, you know, G.I. Joes or baseball cards.
Right. And this, so anybody who's listening who understands basic bookkeeping will grasp these simple journal entries very quickly. We're going to talk about three specific journal entries today. Each one, I refer to them as intra-bank, meaning the whole transaction takes place within one bank as opposed to involving two or more banks. If we involved more than one bank, the net effect would be the same, but it would just take more journal entries. It's much easier to just have it all take place within one bank.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the problems with banks, as we've talked about before, banks are the sole creators of money in our system. Part of the problem is that because they are the sole creators and extinguishers of money, and that one of their main methods of creating money is by funding loans, they create more debt, that is principal and interest owed, than they do actually the money. This obviously leads to a shortfall, which we'll be getting into. Also, that what we're going to learn today and discuss is that this system is by design. It's not by accident. It's not due to mismanagement. This is the way it was set up, which tells us this system was set up deliberately to not work for the benefit of the people.
Yeah, it seems very much to be rigged to fail from the beginning.
Exactly. And the one thing that's originally was hard for me to grasp, but I now get, is that, and this goes back to the quote from John Adams, which I really love. There's two ways to conquer and enslave a nation. Note the words conquer and enslave.
Mm-hmm.
There's two ways to conquer and enslave a nation. One is by the sword, the other by debt. Well, the sword, if you're able to effect it, the conquering will be in relatively short amount of time. If you go with debt, it's going to take a long time. But it's incremental by encroachment, which means people won't really feel what's coming. Which means if you're going to conquer and enslave a country by debt, you already have an extremely long timetable in your mind. This is going to take decades and decades, or 100 years or so. But it is so constant, it is so consistent, it is so incremental, it goes unnoticed. The people who created this system created a system that required an extreme amount of patience, and they apparently have it.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to throw that old time-worn adage out there, but the frog in the pot, but it seems to be that's exactly what this is all about. I mean, they just keep increasing the heat, and they generationally have done it. So, I mean, most of the folks, if we're looking at the 1913, are dead and gone by now. So, you know, they sort of kick that can down the road, and you see millennials or people in 2019 looking at this and going, it'll be fine. There's no problem. They're not gonna. They wouldn't really hurt us. They're out for our best interest. They wouldn't intentionally crash the monetary system.
Right, right. I mean, in essence, what we're talking is a fairy tale that we're taught to believe is true. You know, there is a Santa Claus, there is a Tooth Fairy, and everything's okay. It's a great story. It's just not true. The first journal entry to talk about is what people in the system will admit to. And this is how money, M1 money, is created. It's a simple loan. Mm-hmm. And for this discussion, it's going to be, as I said, intrabank. I will be the bank, and John, you can be the other party.
All okay? Right.
You come into the bank of Allen and you want to borrow some money. I said, okie dokie. And I, you know, we do all the paperwork and everything. And the journal entry I post into my bank's general ledger is very simple. The debit is to an asset called loan receivable. Loan receivable, John.
Okay.
The debit increases that account, which means I now have a receivable that has a balance in it. The offsetting and equal credit goes to a checking account in your name, which on my book shows up as a liability. So now I have a loan receivable that's increased, and you have a checking account that's increased by the same amount. And since checking accounts are part of the M1 money supply, there's no offsetting decrease anywhere within my bank or within the banking monetary system. I, the Bank of Allen, by hitting enter, just created new M1 money. This is how this is how money is created in our system today.
For me, that's still a lot to take in. Let's underscore that. The bank just with a keystroke created M1 money. All right.
That's it. Now, there's supposed to be certain limitations on how much money, M1 money, the Bank of Allen can create. It's called the Federal Reserve Requirement. And depending on my reserves will depend on how much money, new money I can create. And at the max, it's 10%, which means for every dollar of reserve I have, I can create $10 worth of money. Hmm. What we'll find out is that that's not really working, but we'll get to that.
All right.
All right. I, the Bank of Allen, just created a loan or funded the loan. You have money in a checking account, which I'll make any claims on that I'll make good on, and you owe me for the loan. Well, that's journal entry one. Journal entry two is, well, John, you got to start making payments. And to give you a background on this, let's say, for example, because I did the full amortization on this, let's say the loan was $300,000. It's a 30-year fixed 5%. Round numbers, you're going to have to make a payment of $1,600 a month for 30 years. Okay?
Gotcha.
Now, I want to give you the whole background on this, and then we'll get into the specific journal entry. Your loan payment of $1,600 gets divided between principal and interest every month. In the beginning of the loan, of course, most of the $1,600 goes to interest, and then whatever remains goes to principal. And in the first loan payment, it's going to be $1,300 to interest and $300 to principal.
Okay.
All right? Well, you look at this, the whole history of this loan, and at about 15 and a half years between principal and interest, you will have had to pay me, the Bank of Allen, basically $300,000. Yet, there's still 14 and a half years left on the loan, and between the principal and interest owed, you owe me another $280,000. As you can see, this system deliberately creates money shortage. Anyway, so the first loan payment, as we said, is $1,600. You write me a check. I negotiate the check, which means I will debit your bank account. I will reduce your bank account by $1,600. That money just got extinguished because it's not going into any other account. It goes away. It goes to vapor. It doesn't exist anymore. It is extinguished. I reduce your principal by $300, and I increase my interest income by $1,300. So think about this for a moment. Your bank account balance went down $1,600. But your debt to me only went down $300. Think you're short of cash?
One would think.
And this will continue on over and over again. Bottom line, this system, the way it's set up, since only the principal is created and not the interest, there's this ultimate chronic shortage of funding. And people might say, well, Alan, you know, if that's the case, how come this system didn't collapse so long ago? Well, one of the reasons that there's more money in the system, which you get through earning wages or whatever else and are able to continue to make payments, is banks continue to create more money by funding loans. But as we just saw, there's such a rapid reduction in the money supply, money being extinguished, by the amount of interest being posted into the or about being paid, well, all the banks in the world can't keep up with this shortage. Somebody will say, well, then where's the other source of money? Because this is the only way banks create money.
Okay.
And the answer is no, this is not the only way banks create money. There's another way. And this is the way that banks create money that no one is talking about. It's not subject to a reserve requirement. Banks can create this kind of money, and they do. And this is why we actually have more money in the supply. And this is why we have inflation. Well, not only are you, John, a borrower of the Bank of Allen, you're an employee. And you happen to be a very good employee. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
You're welcome. And it's payday time. Many or most banks offer their employees a free checking account.
Okay.
I work at the Bank of Allen. I'm going to get a free account. Taking it. Once again, this entry is intra-bank. At the end of the day, all you care about is that your bank account balance goes up for the net wages you've earned, gross less all the withholding, okay?
Gotcha.
That's a credit entry. What's the offsetting debit? What else? Wage expense. I, the Bank of Allen, just created money, increased the M1 money supply, not by funding a loan, but by satisfying, note I don't say pay, by satisfying an expense. This is completely outside the limitation of any Federal Reserve requirement. No one's talking about that this is how banks create money. Basically, if a bank increases a checking account balance, they can put the debit anywhere. They can put it to the asset loan receivable. They could put it to any other asset, such as office furniture, cars, investments, or they can put the debit to an expense account. The kicker with the expense account entry is that for tax purposes, banks are treated as regular corporate taxpayers, just like every other corporate business. Yet there's not one expense being recorded on a bank's corporate income tax return that was actually paid for. Paid for you and me is we go out of pocket. We have less money.
Gotcha.
Well, when a bank posts an expense to its general ledger and uses it to reduce its taxable income, that's not because it paid for it. It's because it created the money. Which means every expense on a bank's tax return is there because they created money, not paid it out. A bank will never have to pay in any way, shape, or form, pay for an expense it uses as a deduction on its tax return. I'll leave it to you to decide whether that's tax fraud or not. And if it is, it's massive, systemic, and by design.
Man, that's crazy.
And to give you a little, or to give what I've said a little support, in the first quarter of 2014, a group out of the Bank of England called the Monetary Analysis Directorate, yeah, MAD, what a name, they produced a quarterly bulletin called Money Creation in the Modern Economy. And if you read the first page or two, it's about 12 pages. If you read the first page or two and then get to the conclusion, that's all you need to do. Now remember, this is from the Bank of England's Monetary Analysis Directorate. This is no Pentagon paper. This was just out there on the web, which I found. And in the conclusion, and I'm going to paraphrase part of it, it says that banks create, commercial banks themselves create money whenever they lend to someone in the economy. That was journal entry one.
Gotcha.
Okay. Or, this is the kicker, buy an asset from consumers. What I read out of this is the Bank of England is telling me that banks create money when they buy an asset from a consumer. That's someone out in the economy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you can create money when you acquire an asset, office furniture, cars, office building, whatever.
That's what I'm thinking.
If you're creating money then of course you can create money by satisfying an expense. The Bank of England, as far as I'm concerned, supports what I just said in Journal Entry 3. So what we have here is a monetary system that allows banks to be the sole creators of money, creators and extinguishers of money. And as Journal Entry 2 reveals, when you make that loan payment, it's not just the principal that's being extinguished, that's going out of existence. It's the entire payment. And as we talked about the first payment, you're out of pocket $1,600, but your principal only went down $300.
Mm-hmm.
You're already short on cash. If you decide to pay off the whole loan, you're $1,300 short. And you can see how this magnifies year after year.
And they're just making the money disappear as you pay off the loan.
It gets extinguished. It goes out of existence. Now, we've heard many times thin air,
mm-hmm,
regarding money. Well, I would put it this way. I've never heard anyone refer to any entity's balance sheet, income statement, accounting records as coming out of thin air. It comes out of, nowadays, the computerized accounting system. And people do all kinds of work to create it, get the information in, get the information out. But no one ever uses the term thin air. Well, it's this same process of fingertips on a keyboard, hit enter, that produces financial statements that also creates and extinguishes money. So for someone to say that money comes out of thin air, they don't understand how it's really working. Because no one ever says that balance sheets and income statements come out of thin air. They don't. It's a result of an accounting process. That's not thin air. What we have is a monetary system, as I said, that gives the sole power to create and extinguish money to banks. Yet by their own definition, and the Fed's definition, and the U.S. Treasury's definition, only people in our businesses actually have, hold, use, spend M1 money. Banks have no money, no M1 money in their own name. They only have reserves. Why is an entity that never will have money in its own name or use money in its own name, why is that industry creating money for us? Because it does it for our detriment. We have literally, not figuratively, we literally have more debt in this country than we have money to pay it off. We've talked about this before. The Treasury debt is now north of $22 trillion. That in itself is unpayable. Then you have the unfunded liabilities, which are called Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. A professor out of Boston, Lawrence Kotlikoff, in 2012 estimated that the unfunded liabilities, that means liabilities that will be owed in the future, but there's no fund set aside to pay them, so the term unfunded, he did the present value of those and estimated it to be $200 trillion, even if it's half of that. Then you have all the debts owed by all the states, the counties, the cities, the municipalities, the people, and the businesses. This monetary system creates more debt than money to pay off the debt. This is a monetary system. Its failure is not an if, it's a when. And to me, the when is just... It's like a wheel spinning faster and faster. We are so close to the end because the national debt's unpayable. If the interest spikes up, it will become unserviceable. You have a lot of really weak institutions internationally, including Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank is the 15th largest bank in the world. It happens to hold the world's largest book of derivatives. Derivatives are essentially gambling. It's not investment in assets. It's bets on what will happen. And their book of derivatives is $40 trillion. They're hanging on by their fingers. And their stock price over the last 10 years or so, and I believe this is in euros, has gone from 100 down to under 7.
Wow. That's quite a decline.
And then you have banks creating money to satisfy expenses, using those expenses to reduce their taxable income, thus their tax liability. Gee, what could go wrong with this system?
I mean, that should boggle everyone's mind. So, I mean, your local bank up the street is creating money, in essence, to have the furniture, to, I guess, keep the lights and the plumbing and the...
You know, everything.
Everything.
Right.
Where you and I and the guy up the street that's got his own lawn care business, you know, we're actually having to get our own M1 money. We're not just tapping on a keyboard to create it.
Exactly. Just so people understand, I'm not anti-bank. I'm not anti-bank building. I'm not anti-bank people. We need banks. Absolutely. My main proposition is leave banks alone. You know, all we're going to do is take the power to create money, which was given to them by the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, and take it back and return it to the control and the benefit of the people and our country. And I've talked about it before. My suggestions, of course, can be tweaked, whatever, but the point is when the benefit of money creation rests with the people of this country, in a unified basis, we can use that power as we the people to fund our federal government so it does not need to tax us and has no need to borrow. I think that's a huge win-win.
Sure.
Yet, you know, this is what needs to be talked about. And the other is your taxing authorities will hunt you down for $1,000 or less.
Sure.
Where are all these agencies, the IRS, the SEC, the FTC, banking regulators? Where are they when – I mean, this is simple and, to me, irrefutable. This is how money is created in our system. It's created when they fund loans. It's created when banks acquire assets, as the Bank of England admits. And, of course, as an offshoot of that, money is created when banks satisfy expenses. Yet, as regular corporate taxpayers, they're using those expenses, which they never can, will, or have to pay for out of pocket like we do,
mm-hmm.
and they reduce their taxable income. Now imagine you have a corporation and you post all kinds of expenses into your books and put them on the tax return that you will never have to, need to, can pay for. Is that a tax problem?
Jeez.
That's our banking system at its bare bones, rock bottom basics. You look to these three journal entries, you understand how the system works, and you understand why we're in the situation we are and the fact that we are being conquered by debt. Yet we still don't really feel the pressure. We accept inflation. We accept federal income taxation. We accept unpayable national debt and state debt and county debt and city debt. We just accept it. So the call to action is really simple. And I think I've shared with you a draft email, which you might want to post up on your system.
Okay.
Which is, you know, it's one thing to analyze and complain and, you know, get upset about something bad. But if there's no specific doable call to action, well, this is just a complaint fest.
That's it, man.
Well, to me, the call to action is very simple. It takes maybe 10 minutes a day. And you could do it on your couch, sitting in your jammies. You make three phone calls to the people in D.C. who allegedly represent you. I like to call them elected employees. And you call them, leave a message, most likely. You send them an email. Two in the Senate, one in the House. And you basically tell them, fix this problem or don't come home. Now, if you look at Module 17, and there's a draft email, which if you want, you can post up on your system so people can see it.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
And I use the term elected employee to really frame the discussion, which is these people, yeah, they're elected, but they're employees. We, the people, we're the citizen owners. And the problem is the owners aren't telling the employees what to do. And I've posed this situation to people, and I'll pose it to you. Imagine you decide you're going to start a little business. You go out and rent some property. You get inventory. You advertise. You interview. You hire. And you train new employees.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, everything just right. You open up the door first day of business and you walk away.
Yeah.
How good's your business going to do?
It's going to go down pretty quick.
Right. So what do? We hire employees. It's called an election. Most of us never meet or vet or train or keep track of our employees. We let them go away to some distant place. We don't track what they do. And really, we're surprised that our business, our national government, isn't working in our best interest? Okay, we've set this up. We can fix it. Now, for those who are old enough to remember the movie Deliverance, do you remember Deliverance?
Oh, I love it. That's a great movie.
Well, when I saw it, I had a much different reaction. I remember walking out of the movie theater. It's night. We're walking across the parking lot, and I said to myself, oh, my gosh. Well, I didn't say it quite that way, but yeah, you can get an idea. I'm going back to cartoons.
Oh, yeah, it was dark. It was definitely a dark movie.
Well, anyway, if you remember the backwoods scenes.
Yeah.
Okay, you can tell the elected employees what's going on in three words. And that's why I bring up Deliverance.
Okay.
Three words. So you can take this whole email and eventually narrow it down to three words. And all you have to do is say repeal or squeal.
Mm-hmm.
Got to repeal the Federal Reserve Act and all their amendments. Got to take the power to create money away from banks, return it to an entity that is owned, controlled, directed, monitored, and reports to the people. And this is the entity that will create the funding to fund the federal government based on approved budgets. You could also use this system based on approved emergency measures to create more federal funding. God forbid we have a national emergency.
Seriously.
and that way the funding can be created. To get any excess funding out of the system so it's not inflationary, and I call it a national institution, the National Institute, National Bank, could levy a sales or consumption tax, different locales, different percentages on different things, not to generate any kind of cash, inflow, revenue, whatever. It's simply to bring the monetary system's supply down. And once the supply is in harmony with the economic level, sales tax goes away. The sales tax is just a tool to prevent inflation. It's not to do anything else. So it really comes down to us, we the people. This is our country. We are the citizen owners. It's time we start to act like citizen owners. It's time that we tell our elected employees, you guys have really messed up. To use a phrase from the movie The Right Stuff, you guys have totally screwed the pooch.
Yeah.
It's time. We have to take this, because if we don't, this system is going to fail. It's not an if. It's not a maybe. It's simply a when. And when this goes down, the way I look at this, it will be so massive, so systemic in nature, it will make the Great Depression look like a picnic.
Yeah, I fear that's where we're headed, because, you know, a lot of people mention this, but, I mean, during the Great Depression, everyone was kind of more agrarian. Most people had farms. Most people knew how to survive. I mean, if we see something even probably a tenth of what happened in the Great Depression, we're going to see far more than a few million die off, I feel.
To me, I agree. We had much more, many more rural communities than we do now.
Mm-hmm.
But with the Great Depression, which, if you go back to the words of Milton Friedman, Nobel Prize-winning economist, he and another economist, Anna Schwartz, wrote a book on the history of money in the U.S. But Milton Friedman is quoted as saying that the Fed definitely, Fed being the Federal Reserve System, the Fed definitely caused the Great Depression.
Absolutely.
Now think about it. You're a big time executive at a company running the finances, and you so mess up, John, that the company almost fails. Do you have a job the next day?
Not a chance.
Yet the Fed definitely, according to Milton Friedman, Nobel Prize winning economist, definitely caused the Great Depression. Fed's still on the job. Now, somebody might come back and say, well, yeah, I get that, but, you know, come on, that's just one guy's opinion. That's not necessarily what went down. Well,
there are other opinions.
Let's pull another opinion, shall we?
Yeah.
You know the name Ben Bernanke?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I like to call him Uncle Ben, but I'm just kidding. Ben Bernanke gave a very long presentation in November of 2002, commemorating Milton Friedman's 90th birthday. And right at the end, this is absolutely right at the end, he makes this comment. Remember that in 2002, he is a member of the board of the board of governors. He's not yet the chairman.
Gotcha.
This is a quote. Let me end my talk by abusing slightly my status as an official representative of the Federal Reserve, member of the board of governors. I would like to say to Milton and Anna, Milton Friedman, Anna Schwartz, who I previously mentioned, regarding the Great Depression, you're right, we did it. We're very sorry, but thanks to you, we won't do it again. In that one sentence, or two sentences, he admits the Fed definitely caused the Great Depression, which is basically backing up the facts, and then he says, we won't do it again. Okay. If there ever was a lie. But now you have the words of Ben Bernanke, then member of the Board of Governors, admitting the Fed definitely caused the Great Depression. The system does not work for the people. Yet it needs to work for the people. In the Great Depression, you had unemployment at 25%. You had people losing their farms, their ranches, their homes, their businesses. Who do you think got all that property? Do you think it was the lenders?
I don't think so.
No, it was the lenders.
Oh, that's okay.
Yeah.
Oh, the lenders. You mean like the banks. I got
the banks.
Okay.
Yeah, they got it. And one thing that doesn't, if you look at the pictures from the Great Depression, they're all black and white. You have people actually pretty well dressed. You'll have men in suits, women in dresses, everybody's got a hat on. And where are they standing? They're standing in a food line. Okay, what does not really come across, unless you really, really look hard, is how absolutely gut-wrenchingly disappointed and embarrassed these people are. A friend of mine from the Midwest, hold on one second.
Sure.
When he was growing up, somebody came, and this is outside the Great Depression. Somebody came, a man came to their house's back door, knocked on it. His mom answered. And the man was looking for work. And he said he'd work for a plate of food. The mom said, you know, I really don't have anything to give you. I don't have any work for you, but I will give you a plate of food. He said, I can't take it, and he walked away. This guy is hungry enough to work for food. He's offered food, but he won't take it if he can't work. So you get an idea of the mentality of these people standing in a bread line. They are so broken. And who broke them?
Yep.
The monetary system. We need to take this back because the way I look at it, I am an offspring of the greatest generation. And I think to myself, what have I done? What am I doing as an offspring of the greatest generation to help protect and save and serve my country? America is not a free ride.
can't help but think of when you were talking about this, I've sort of covered this the last few shows in my intro, just this stark contrast that you really exemplified that in what you were saying. In that generation, people took pride when they left the house. I mean, people wouldn't leave the house in pajamas and curlers, you know, even in the proverbial breadline, they had a nice suit on and a pair of slacks or dresses for the ladies. If you contrast that to where we are now, I've sort of covered this. It takes me a lot to get out of the house sometimes just because when I go out, it's so disturbing. I mean, I go out and there's people just, I just term it as like a mass unit when you go to a lot of the big box stores, and we've all seen it. There will be the person, I'm trying to be nice here, but, you know, in the pajamas and flip-flops and just looking like bad, and they'll have the cart full of stuff, and they'll have all the EBT card stuff ready to go. And if you juxtapose that to what you were saying, it's gut-wrenching still just looking at how far we've degraded as a people. It's just sad.
Yes. And in part, I would say that what we don't have in our system, and this is the only way this could continue for so long, for so many decades, we do not really have an adequate financial literacy education at the primary level.
True.
The other thing that we don't have that has been taken away is a civics education. What we don't have and has been taken away is a solid education as to what the Constitution really is. What went behind it? What they were thinking, all the negotiations that took place to create such a document and to bring such a country into existence. I've talked to people, and the Constitution is old. It was written by slave owners.
It's those old white guys. That's all.
Yeah, it's out of date. It's not hip. It's not happening. It's not techie. I'm going, have you read the Constitution? Do you really understand what it means? And the forethought. One of the interesting
sure.
things about in the Constitution is that, again, back then you had, in essence, free states and slave states. And there was going to have to be a compromise to bring all of them together. And one of the compromises that is not talked about is that 10 years after the signing, I think it was 1801, it was agreed that they would have to wait till 1801 to propose a new law that prohibited the importation of slaves into the country anymore.
Hmm.
That was the compromise. So obviously people did care about this. And yes, slavery is an absolutely abhorrent, terrible, godless thing. When did the law pass to prohibit the importation of slaves into this country? That would be 1801.
Gotcha.
They waited not one moment extra to get that done. They cared. They really cared. But now is our time.
Yeah.
Our time for us to step up. The greatest generation, the sacrifice that happened on the battlefield, the sacrifices that happened in the U.S. are massive and huge, and hopefully we will never have to experience such a thing. But they fought back against absolute tyranny. Nazi Germany, imperialist Japan.
Mm-hmm.
They fought back and they defeated absolute total tyranny to give us what we have today. Well, those are external enemies of America. Well, my phrase is, we have a domestic enemy. And domestic enemy number one is our monetary system. And it's time that America wakes up and makes a conscious choice. Am I going to demand the change or just sit back, rub a lamp, and hope?
Yeah, keep making excuses. That's why I love your action plan here. I mean, you give us all this good information, and then you're not just going to sort of dot, 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 and fade off into silence. You're saying, hey, look at Module 17. All you got to do is draft. You know, there's the draft. You got to fill in the blanks, make some emails and some phone calls once a week. I mean, surely.
No. Not once a week.
Oh, once a day?
Once a day. 10 minutes.
I got you. All right. Even better.
10 minutes a day. And then in the meantime, you talk to your family members, you talk to your neighbors, your friends, your coworkers, whomever, and explain this. Because if we do not my little saying is this, you either fix the problem or the problem fixes you.
True.
And we're not going to like the fix. That this problem, it will make the Great Depression look like a picnic. There's no question about it. Mm. We will get absolutely hammered. And we don't have a bunch of people living on a farm. We have people living in cities with little or no access to the ability to grow food and have access to water and power. How many people needed that much electricity back in the 30s?
I would encourage people to look at those old pictures like you were talking about. Take a gander on the internet and look up Great Depression photographs because there's a wealth of them. I mean, that would make the modern sci-fi zombie apocalypse look pretty tame if you multiply that times probably 100 because that's what we got going on now.
Exactly, and these people are not smiling. They're not happy. They're embarrassed. They're ashamed. I don't have a job. I don't have a job.
Mm-hmm.
And what came out of the Great Depression, and I get it, and I'm not going to fault the people, we gave so much power to the federal government. And the federal government has not stopped taking power. There's only so much power in our system. And if more and more power goes to the central government, the people have less and less, which means the owners no longer are the owners.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that surprised me about, I believe this is correct. If not, somebody will let me know. Apparently, you only have to be in the House or the Senate for 5 years before you get a lifetime pension. Nice, huh?
You need to start running for office.
This is absurd. This is absolutely absurd. You take a federal office because you want to help the country, not because you expect an endless payday for the rest of your life. And who do you think voted on that pension plan?
I'd say their peers.
Yeah. Definitely an inside job. So that's what I've got today for the accounting.
Well, that sounds terrific. I'm definitely going to sort of make a copy of this and put the Module 17 draft into your guest information. So maybe
do that.
Some people will make this happen.
Again, you make the phone calls, you send the emails, you get other people involved because – one day we're either going to win or we're going to lose. There's no in between. And I don't want to face the younger generation and explain to them why we didn't get it done. Can I follow up one last quote?
Sure, absolutely. Go for it, sir.
Okay. Actually, I'm going to give you two.
Even better.
There is a historian by the name of Carol Quigley. This guy he wrote a monster book. By the way, his wife typed the transcript. This is a monster book called Tragedy and Hope. This is what he, this is just a quote out of it. It's kind of long, but it's very interesting. This was written in 1966. The powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system, was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. Pretty scary so far, huh?
Everybody should take note. This is old Bill Clinton's mentor from Georgetown.
I keep going.
Yeah.
The apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. This is 1966.
He's laying it all out.
Laid it all out. Finally, this is from 2002. This is from David Rockefeller, head of the Klan, from his book Memoirs. And I know that this is straight out of the book because I found the book. This is so scary, it makes me shiver. For more than a century, ideological extremists at either end of the political spectrum have seized upon well-publicized incidences, such as my encounter with Castro, to attack the Rockefeller family for the inordinate influence they claim we wield over American political and economic institutions. Some even believe we are part of a secret cabal working against the best interest of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists, and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure. One world, if you will. Okay, this is what he's saying is being said about him and his family.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty horrendous, wouldn't you say?
You would think so.
Okay, this is the final line of the quote. Keep in mind what I just said, in working against the best interest of the United States. That sounds like treason to me.
You would think so.
The last line is this: if that is the charge, I stand guilty and I'm proud of it. Okay, this is not by accident. This is by deliberate intent. This is by design. And we, the people, have the ability, we have the power, we have the need, we have the responsibility and the duty to protect our country, our Constitution, not just for us, but as the founders would say, for posterity, for the future. It's on us today.
And just to connect dots to people for the Rockefellers, in case you somehow missed this, the Rockefellers were the owners of Standard Oil, who had a monopoly corporation that had to get broken up. They were also supplying the fuel for Hitler. They were also the ones that donated the land for the UN in New York. I could just keep on going with what this illustrious family, who he says, I stand guilty and I'm proud of it.
He stands guilty and he's proud of working against the best interests of the United States. He's proud of and he stands guilty of conspiring and working against the best interests of the United States and working to build a one world.
When you have
one world and you have a one world government, you have no freedom, liberty, or rights. you have no longer any individual countries. Mm-hmm. History is wiped away. Culture is wiped away. Tradition is wiped away. And you serve the state, which to me is a method and a process that turns humans into nothing more than widgets off an assembly line.
Yeah.
Each one has literally virtually no value because they're all viewed the same.
To piggyback on the Carol Quigley mention, I mean, it brings in that global feudalist society where people are nothing more than just chattel slavery to the elites. That's what's up.
If you cannot work, if you cannot produce for me, you have no value.
Mm-hmm.
Goodbye.
Then they can implement the eugenics plans that they'd always dreamed of. So they can just say, oh, well, no longer have a disability system. Our disability system is you go over there to that pit and you'll meet that guy with a gun. So
he's our disability administrator.
Yeah, he's the expert.
Yeah, and I think Margaret Sanger was into eugenics.
Oh, yeah, with the Cold Springs Harbor Institute, yeah.
Yes.
Her and Hitler were pen pals. They were sending information back and forth. You know, Hitler was like, oh, I'm so jealous of what you got going on. I wish I could implement that here.
It's all it takes is looking a little bit underneath the surface to get to bedrock.
Mm-hmm.
What we've talked about today is basically the bedrock, the foundation of banking. It comes down to nothing more than journal entries. You get that, you understand it, you see what change needs to be implemented, how the change is implemented, and the benefits are we get rid of three things that have become absolutely normalized, accepted, not viewed as a problem: inflation, federal income taxation, and national debt. Okay. When people finally see these things as three absolute evils and completely unnecessary under a proper monetary system, that really sheds the light on what this current system is doing to us and our country and our future.
Sounds good to me. I'm ready to go. Let's do it.
All right. I'm sure we'll be talking more.
Absolutely. Well, I'll definitely put that link on the website. So hopefully everyone can get out there and start doing this. I mean, I always end the show with saying, you know, you can't do everything, but you can do something. And in this case, Alan's giving you everything but the stamp. Just call these people. Email these people. And
yeah,
stop talking about Netflix and the game at the next stupid family function and just maybe tip your toe in the water and try to tell people some of really what's going on. That'd be nice. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And do you want to tell everybody about your Red Pill Expo presentation as well, just in case people want to check that out? I know that's coming
yes.
up.
Yes. This weekend in Hartford, Connecticut, is the Red Pill Expo 2019. You can check it out on the web. I will be there for the whole event, but I will be speaking on Saturday, June 8th, 3 p.m. East Coast time. And I will be basically speaking on this topic. If you can't make it, you can live stream the event for a very low cost. And I believe if you live stream, you have many days of access to it. But definitely check it out. It begins Friday, June 7th, and it goes through Sunday, June 9th. And I will be there for the whole event. If you do happen to show up, find me, come say hello. If you can't make it, do check out the website, and highly recommend that you do the live stream. There's going to be so many great presenters on so many topics. It's going to be eye-opening. Thank you for that.
I wish I could make it up there. I was looking into it. I just couldn't pull it off this time, but there'll definitely be a number of speakers there that have been on the program, so please check it out.
Live stream it. Absolutely.
All right. Well, we definitely look forward to talking to you again soon, Alan. I hope you take care out there.
I will. Thank you very much, everybody. Be safe and well. Bye-bye.
All right, you too. We are pleased to welcome onto the Anomic Age today, Ms. Pamela Adams. So, let me give you the rundown. Graduating from college with a mathematics degree, Pamela began her dream of teaching with a position at an inner-city Houston school. She moved on from teaching to manage a comedy club and marketing director of a credit union. In the workforce for 20 years, life changed when her daughter arrived. I can relate to that. Having worked in public schools for a decade, she understood how they were failing our children, and she wanted to make sure that didn't happen to her own child. Concur. She began to study history and write down what she learned, composing history letters to her daughter. They were addressed to Liberty, the childlike freedom that belongs to all of us. Pamela's letters tie the past to current events, showing how we consistently repeat history because we never are properly taught it. Pamela, thank you so much for being on the program. Sorry we got off to a rocky beginning, but we're going to smooth out, I hope.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to talk to you because if nothing else, I was inspired by what you were doing because my own frustration just lies in I guess people's apathy or at least what I perceive it to be because I'm just like you. I'm bombarded with all this stuff every single day. I mean, I feel like I need to detox a week sometimes. I mean, even if you just look at the mainstream news, you're disgusted enough. And then if you really go down the rabbit hole and get into what's really happening, it's like, oh, my, we're doomed. We're doomed. Yeah, I want to get a sign and go out on the street corner and just start ringing a bell and saying we're doomed.
Yes, I'm right there with you.
And then I get caught up with the posting as well. I'm like, all right, we know this is wrong. We knew that 10 years ago. And then what? You know, I'm like, where's the action? So I was really excited to see your action. I was enthralled with happiness. I was like, you're doing it. You're doing what we need to be doing.
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things. If we don't take something upon ourselves, who's going to do it? So.
Yeah.
I'm right there with you. I will tell you, though, studying the history does actually give you some comfort because you look at it and you say, oh, we've been through this before and we survived. So that does actually help and add a little comfort to, because I'm right there with you. There's days I will tell my husband, I'm like, why am I doing this? What difference am I making? And it is getting anywhere, but it does make a difference. If nothing else, just for me and my family.
We probably have a similar story. And much like the last guest I spoke with the other day, it's the same sort of thing. When you have your child, that, in my opinion, it's for the best, but it totally throws that monkey wrench in your life that I think we all probably have needed, where you like get splashed with the water and he's shaking around like, you got to make sure you don't foul this up.
Oh, amen. Well, it was one of those, my husband and I never planned on having children.
Mm-hmm.
And we were coming up to our 19th anniversary when we found out we were pregnant.
Oh, wow.
And I had just started a new job, but God said, no, it's not just a new job. You're getting a new career.
Yes.
So when we found out she was coming, there was two big questions. Would I continue working? And what were we going to do about her education? Because as you said in my promo, I've been part of the education system and I knew how bad it was. And that was not, public school was not an option. So we fortunately had made some good financial decisions that I could quit and I became a stay-at-home mom. And then it came down to what we would do for school. And that's part of the reason why I started studying the history because homeschooling was an option and it still is.
Sure.
We have a really good school at our church. So because she is an only child and we wanted her to have some of that interaction, have some friends and have a little bit of that social skill. There is something to that. We decided to put her in that through eighth grade because our school goes through that. And then I will take over for high school. So I'm preparing. So that's why I started doing the research. And as like most people, I forget if I don't write it down. So that's why I kind of started the blogs, because it was not just interesting for me. I'm like, hey, other people might enjoy this. So that's really how the ball started rolling with putting the blogs together.
That's fascinating. I'm right there with you. I'm still trying to get out of the cult of academia. Like, I always tell people, I don't know how I got into this, but it's sort of like a monetary thing now. It's like, well, I got to get out of this thing, but they're still paying me. Yeah. So I guess I'll still show up. Well, I mean, the pay keeps decreasing each year. I think God has sort of, for the last 5 years, he's been going, you got to get out of this, John. And he keeps taking money away, and you got to get out of this. And pretty soon I'm going to be working at the Zip Mart and then teaching just one class.
I get the joy of the teaching because I do feel like I am teaching through the letters, and I have people write me and they'll ask me questions and, have you done anything about this, topic, and I can discuss it or answer whatever question they have. So I do feel I'm still teaching. Unfortunately, I'm absolutely making no money. So
I can feel that pain. Yes. Yeah, I'm glad you got out of it, though. I mean, out of the public school thing.
I will say, I would go into the teacher's lounge. My school was big enough that each department had their own lounge, and I would go in there during my conference period, and there was one particular teacher. He had been on 20 years, had 5 more to go, and every day it was just him complaining about the kids and the administration and this and that, and he had 5 more years. There was nothing he could do. He was stuck in it. And I'm like, I just got started. I just have 5 years. I've got 20 more to go.
Yeah. No,
I can't know. And I just saw the writing on the wall, and I said, I need to get out now while I can, because I didn't want to be in his position. Mm-hmm. I can't do anything. I've got 5 more years, and if I leave now, I lose everything. And I'm like, I'm starting over. So.
Yeah, it's a terrifying prospect. I mean, my mom taught for 37 years public school.
Oh, wow.
And I'm in the, I don't even know if I want to say it's better, in the university cult of academia. So it's a different branch of the same cult. But yeah, people have always asked me, like, well, you could get benefits. You could go teach at the high school. And I'm like, no, because I've heard those stories that you're talking about.
Oh. I had one kid look at me, and he was being a pain, and he looked at me and says, what are you going to do to me?
Yeah.
And I'm like, you're right. I can't. They took away my ability. When I was growing up, if you said something like that to the teacher, they had every right to turn you over their knee and swat you right there or mm-hmm. take you down to the principals and do it. But the kid was right. He knew there was nothing I could do. You had to make a list of all these times you called the parents or all these disciplinary actions you did before you even could send them down to the principal's office. So the teachers become just paper pushers. They took away your ability to teach because you were forced to deal with, and it's only a small portion in most classrooms, 1-2 kids that cause a lot of the problem, but then you're having to deal with them and all the other kids suffer. And it's a very sad situation. Fortunately, a lot of parents are waking up and they are looking at different opportunities. And with the online courses that they now have, and that's kind of what my blogs, at the end of the year, I put them together in a book. And the thought is parents could get these books and they're history lessons. They could go through these and teach us as a history lesson and then ask the kids questions and do further research. And that's really kind of where the whole program comes together.
So is that what kind of got you started on this, like the birth of your child and then your own
yes.
disillusionment with the cult?
Exactly, because without children, we're like, well, okay, we'll go, and then people are going to have to. When I had her, reality hit that, no, you now have a stake in the future of this. You now have someone who will go on and hopefully have her own children. And you want to make sure things are good for her. So what are you going to do about it?
Mm-hmm.
And that was the spark that lit. And it has been such an incredible journey that when I first started doing these, I would pick out this subject or that topic or this event. And I would do it, and it just felt like I was putting all these puzzle pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I've been doing it 5 years, the puzzle pieces, they're now starting to connect. And I will do, what is his name? John Maynard. He was a young black boy, and he ended up starting to preach. He was the first black preacher to the Native Americans back around the Civil War time. He had been influenced by George Whitefield, who was one of the big evangelists, and I had already done a blog on him. And it's just, so I read about this young man who was 13 years old when he started preaching. He was influenced by George, and like, oh, wow, how these things just, the puzzle pieces just go together, and the whole history of how we're all connected, it's just fascinating. I've done genealogy for 26 years now, so I've also done things where I've put my family in with that history. And that's another fascinating avenue of this, is when you take your personal family and their history and how it connects, or if nothing else, what they have done, what they were doing when the Revolutionary War was happening, when the Civil War was happening. What was your parent? What was your grandparents and great grandparents doing at the time? It's just fascinating to me.
Yeah, that does sound really interesting. I've always wanted to get into that too, because there's these large elements in my family where we'd have no idea. It's like, ironically enough, we know more about my mother's side than my father's. My father's side, nobody would tell us anything. It was sort of like this huge secret.
You'll find out when you research. There's probably a reason why.
Yeah.
And I think that actually prepared me for doing this history, because I learned how to research doing that genealogy for so many years and how to find all that history. So it really just, God was putting the little stones together, and I'm just walking down the path.
I love it. I know one thing, probably if you were like me, when I first had my daughter, I started trying to get all this history together, and I got an old history book. The people on the show have heard me say this before, but I got an old history book from the late 1800s, and then one from 45, I want to say. I don't know, but anyway, because I was trying to sort of make up for what was just left out of history, because when I was dumbfounded, because I was reading these books, and I think one of them was like an eighth grade, and then the other one might have been ninth grade. It wasn't honors upper level that you would think of, but I was reading this stuff, and I was blown away because I didn't know any of it. I was like, holy cow, like William Penn was the guy from Pennsylvania? And I was like,
yeah. Oh.
I'm like 41. I never heard this before in my life. This is so sad.
And to a degree, it is. It is. It's just how much we have lost over the years, because schools have become more an indoctrination.
That's the key.
And I just sent out a couple days ago was the anniversary of Charles Sumner. Are you aware of Charles Sumner?
I've heard the name, but it doesn't resonate with me right now.
He was basically the father of the Republican Party.
Hmm.
I can't remember now if he was a Whig or a Democrat. I think he was a Whig. I cannot remember, but at the time, and again, history repeating itself, the Whigs and the Democrats were both going, we're going to solve this slavery issue. We're going to solve this slavery. And then they would not solve the slavery issue. Just like health care, everything that we have, the wall, anything we're dealing with now, we have the same thing going on with the Republicans and the Democrats. We're going to solve it, and they don't. It got the Kansas-Missouri Act was passed. And see, this is why I write it down, because the date's early 1850s. And that started a literal bloodbath out in Kansas, because it nullified the Missouri Compromise of 1820, which said that there was that line that free states above and you could have slaves below. It eradicated that line, because we were kind of working under that. The states were working under that, even though some didn't agree with the slavery, they were working with that. The Kansas-Nebraska Act eradicated that, and it said, no, the states, the new territories, they can decide. So people flooded out there from both free and slave to try to get the most population, and they literally started killing each other. Charles Sumner spoke out about this, several of them got tired of this, so they put together the Republican Party. And very early on, he spoke out about this act. He was pretty mean about it in a speech he gave. And he was targeting two of the legislators that wrote it. One of them was Stephen Douglas, who debated Lincoln in the Stephen Douglas debates. He was one of them. A cousin of this guy comes in. So Charles Sumner's a senator, and Brooks is a representative. He comes over onto the Senate floor. He has a cane, old tip. He starts literally beating Charles Sumner on the floor. The guy is hiding underneath his desk, and he's trying to get away. There's other Democrats that are on the edge that are holding back other senators so they cannot come to Charles's help. If the cane hadn't broke, he would have kept beating Charles Sumner.
Jeez.
And he walked off. No charges were filed on him. In fact, southern states worshipped him. They got little pieces of the cane and put it on necklaces.
Wow.
He elected him.
That sounds very familiar.
Yes, yeah. History repeats. Charles Sumner was out for a while. He actually had to recover. It took him several years to recover. He came back. He finished his speech, and he was there to help get Abraham Lincoln elected. But, again, this I tweeted this out, and people read the story, and they're like, I never heard this before. This is the birth of the Republican Party. And then the Dred Scott decision came in 1857, and that's what really pushed the Republicans into the White House in 1860. The Dred Scott decision, they were like, no, you just determined that a black person was property, that they would never even be citizens. It was an overreach, very much, and I've equated it many times to Roe versus Wade. It's the same type. That is a repeat. It's the Dred Scott decision. But again, yeah, a lot of people don't even know this history. And what's really sad is, how many times have you heard Democrats blame the Republicans for racism and being part of the KKK? And if you don't know this history, and if you don't know that whole timeline of how all that came about, then you're liable to think that it's true when it's completely the opposite.
Yeah, I think that's where we are. I've sort of hinted it time and time again. I think the whole education system is sort of the cornerstone of all of our problems. It's not sort of. I think it is, because they keep, you know, it's like an assembly line of indoctrination. So 60, 70 years ago, they started this mess, and then they keep moving a little Overton window over and a little further, and now we got birth control, now we got abortion, now we take prayer out of schools, now we infuse the colleges with drugs, now we hit the 70s, and we really kick the ball down the road. And
it goes back to Woodrow Wilson.
Yes, it's true.
It goes back to Woodrow Wilson, who was – Teddy Roosevelt was a progressive, but Woodrow Wilson was progressive on steroids. And that's what it was. We're going to progressively bring socialism in. And one of the things was, you get God out.
Mm-hmm.
They took God out. They have broken down our culture. They have broken down our families. And if you look back, you can see it progressively happening. And you are absolutely right. It has got us to this point where we have the drugs, we have the abortions, we have all this stuff. And it's because we have taken all of what made us who we are out.
Yeah.
When I do get books to use as references, I do try to get them before 1950. And if I can, I get them before 1910.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's when they started changing the textbooks, and you really saw that around 1950, and I think you kind of hit on that time period. So, yeah, if you really want more of the truth, you've got to go back and get those that are further before they started changing it.
Yeah, because, I mean, I always say what we're seeing now, people always say, oh, those millennials are crazy and so forth, and I'm like, yes, but they got 12 years of – what's my great thing that I always say? I'm being a little facetious. It's not great. 12 years of indoctrination and 4 years of weaponization. That's kind of what I always term it as. But not only that, they also have had their parents and probably grandparents, if they were 60s on, doing the same thing. So they're going to be reinforcing that same agenda at home because they're going to say, oh, sure, just do what thou wilt. The whole.
Well, look what started happening in the 90s. Participation trophies. We can't give trophies to the winners. We can't keep score. And look what we have now. We have kids who literally melt down when they are told no.
Yeah.
They literally go into a screaming fit if somebody actually has a different point of view. And you're absolutely right. You've got the people that were grown up in the 60s and the 70s became parents in the 90s or 80s, and then they had their kids, you know, in the sports and stuff in the 90s, and it just has now progressed to we are. Are you kidding me? I wrote an article a couple years ago. It was for D-Day or Pearl Harbor, and it was, we couldn't, our kids today, I don't know if they could have fought those battles that we had. It's just, I'm writing now one for D-Day for next week, and I'm reading all my research and some of eyewitness events, people that, you know, talked about what really happened. And I'm looking at this. Look, these are 18, 19-year-old kids. And I'm looking at today's 18, 19-year-old kids. And it's just, beaches of Omaha, they took the boats up. They put the bottom down. They were mowed down by the Germans.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, can our kids do that? Could they wade through the water? Could they drag their buddy up on the beach and help him survive? I don't know. I'm sure we've got some out there, but it's not the population that we should have. That we've taken away the pride in our country, and that's really what has happened. When you take away that, we've only focused on the bad, and I'm not saying we haven't had bad. We focus completely on the bad. We want to continue to demonize the country for the bad without looking at the good and what benefits we have made for ourselves and for the world.
Oh, yeah, it's terrifying. I've gone on a diatribe for the last two shows about how it's just terrifying to leave the house sometimes, but I'll sort of tell the story without giving away the names to protect the guilty, but in the cult that I'm in, they have a field school quite often where the students in the summer have an archaeological thing that they have to do, but anyway, a young lady was recounting this to me a couple years ago because she was in the field school, and part of the thing that they had to do was they had to construct these archaeological screens, which is really just a big square box made out of wood with screen on the bottom. But she was talking to me after class and telling me the story because she said, yeah, you know, there was like a number of girls and a few guys, and none of the men knew how to use the tools. So they had like a drill and I guess a skill saw or maybe a handsaw. I think it was a skill saw. But the bottom line is the women ended up taking over and basically cutting the wood and putting it all together because the guys were just sitting there kind of looking at each other going, I don't know what to do with these crazy tools. They make noise and move around. And I was like, oh, my God, we're doomed. We're just doomed. And these weren't 16-year-olds. I mean, these were... And they had to be a 19 and above, you know, so they weren't, you know, to your analogy with the D-Day thing, yeah, I don't know what we would do. I think we would be not in good shape.
Oh, that is scary.
It was startling.
It's very scary. I don't know if the pendulum is about to swing back or not. I pray it is.
Yeah.
If you kind of look back at the history, I forget his name, but he did the book Pendulum. And he studied it, and he went back. Decades, and it was like every 80 years the pendulum swings, and we are coming up to that, and I think 2022, something where around there. So we can only pray.
I hope so.
It is getting absolutely frightening, and there's times where I look at my daughter and I said, yeah, you're not leaving this house till you're 35.
Yeah.
It's just incredibly scary, but is the on the opposite side of that, I do read, she's only seven, but I read her my blogs, and we talk about this stuff all the time. We talk about current events. We talk about the things that are happening in politics and stuff like that. And sometimes my husband and I look at each other and we're going, okay, she is only 7. And I said, well, yeah, but John Quincy Adams was working as a secretary for his dad in Europe when he was, what, 12?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. George Washington's out surveying on his own when he was 16. So it's that interesting balance of, yeah, you want your kid to still be a kid, but part of the reason we became so great is because kids stepped up and they knew they had to do things. And we've lost that. We've so coddled our children. We don't want our kids to hurt. As mm-hmm. parents, we don't want kids. And I can appreciate that.
Oh, yeah.
We don't ever let them hurt. We don't ever give them the opportunity to learn how to deal with it and get over it and learn from it. And hence, we have millions of snowflakes.
Yeah, I can't remember who was doing this. I know it was a book and a study, but it was basically how America has prolonged adolescence. Kind of like to your point, you know, at D-Day, there was 18-year-olds and even some younger that were lying to get in there on the beaches, and then sort of after that baby boomer generation, it sort of began this decline in the 60s, 70s, and so forth, where it was like, okay, well, you could just go to school for 12 years after you get out of high school, and then you can move back into your mom's basement, and then you can sort of work at the video store, and maybe you can start having your children in your late 40s, I don't know.
Exactly. I mean, I have many, many grandmothers that were in their teens when they were having kids. So it's not like that wasn't happening back then. However, they were getting married and they were raising the family and they were on the farm. And you just stepped up and you did what had to be done. And you're right. Our kids, they're living in the basements till they're 35 and they don't want to face reality. And who was it? Some girl who melted down because she lost all her Instagram followers. What am I going to do? My life is over. I've lost my Instagram followers. You're like, are you kidding me?
They're not even real people. They're just people you'll never, ever see.
Exactly. Half of them are probably fake accounts. It's just, and that is another scary thing, John, that we don't interact the way we used to. You do everything through tweets, and you can have a conversation with somebody, but you have really no idea who you're having a conversation with.
Oh, yeah.
Or on social media, you can put out your thoughts. Maybe some people can comment, but at least we're having a conversation here. We're using the technology, but at least we're talking one-on-one. We have so many that they're on their phones just with their fingers, and they can't. They're being handicapped because they don't have social skills. They're not able to deal with life.
Yeah.
Because they are. They just are so closed off into their own little world. And that's not healthy. It is not healthy.
It's terrible. I've tried to stop teaching in person just about, but it's occurred, I think the last time, which was like two, three years ago, I was teaching in person, but nonetheless, I was walking through the hallways, and it's a university. The guy-to-girl ratio was totally slanted, more women than men. And I was walking through the hallway, and the guys, and we're just sitting there like this. You know, they were sitting right next to a very attractive young lady. They could have been trying to talk or mingle or I don't know, whatever. But nope, it was just like a whole hallway of students doing this. And I was just like, oh, man. It was, again, one of those we're doomed moments.
Well, and that, you know what, that brings up another good point. What's the other thing that we have done that's contributed to that? The Me Too movement.
Oh, yeah.
That's we have frightened the men to even talk to the girls because she might accuse me of something that I really didn't do.
Yeah.
Or she might change her mind. I mean, we have just so messed up the minds of our children. And it's just...
It's terrifying.
It is terrifying. I do wonder, because I was part of the Tea Party movement when it started in 2010, and this was before Trinity. So I was involved from the beginning. Those parents have been, they started doing things different with their kids. They started teaching them. They started searching out those truths and fighting against the indoctrination. So when my daughter came along, I was all right, we're there.
Yeah, you were already on board.
Already on board and doing that. And these kids are now coming up, and they're in the high school, and they're in starting to get into college. So I do wonder, are we going to start seeing a difference? Because those kids, Obama perfectly destroyed the Tea Party movement by with the IRS and his other tyrannical, I'm sorry, he did. He purposely targeted the Tea Party, and he destroyed that movement. However, he didn't destroy the spirit of the people who believed in it. And I do think we are going to start seeing effects of that through the children as they start coming up into the high school years. Because like I said, my daughter's part of that. She's only going to be in second grade. So, I mean, I still have many, many years to indoctrinate her under my own, you know. So by the time she gets up into the high school, and we've been telling her, you don't have to go to college. You can do a trade school. You can do things out on your own. How many people have become so successful and they never were college graduates or even went? I mean, Steve Jobs, Rush Limbaugh. We could sit here and I'm sure name out many. We have convinced these kids that they have to go to college and spend $60,000 on gender studies of the fruit fly.
Yeah.
And they come out expecting to get a six-figure dollar salary? Doing what?
Yeah, they have this cognitive dissonance from the media where they're going, look, all these people on the TV, they're just hanging out all day, and they're still living in a $100,000 apartment and whatever, and I'm going to do that too. I'm going to get my immigrant experience degree, and it's going to work out.
There is just absolutely no... And what it is we're teaching them what to think, not how to think. And we have been telling our daughter, we're trying to teach you how to think. We actually have those conversations. I actually had an evolution discussion with my daughter the other day in the car, 7 years old.
Nice.
And yes, I presented her both. I said, this is creation. This is evolution. And I said, this is where I have questions, and I brought that up, and she's like, yeah, that doesn't make sense, Mom. You know, what does that happen? And so at 7 years old, she is starting to go, yeah, that doesn't make sense. That doesn't flow right. We're not teaching our kids that in a massive way. I mean, individuals like you and I are, but we're not doing that in the schools anymore. That's what school was for.
You would think.
It used to be you had your education by the end of eighth grade. High school was more like a college thing. It was a big deal to go.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's, you know, that's where you go and you play around and you waste 4 years and you get into a lot of trouble. And
yeah, it's so bizarre how it's sort of become the norm that most parents are like, oh, we're going to go through this rough time. And I'm like, why?
Mm-hmm.
It's been this sort of ingrained insanity that people are just taking for granted. I wish I'd have kept better records of this or actually done it as a more legitimate experiment, but I think the last 5 years when I was in person, the first day I would always sort of make them answer a few random questions like, who are you, where are you from, blah, blah, blah. But I sort of started to intentionally put stuff in there just for my own thought. And one of the questions was basically, why are you here? Like, why are you going to university? And I swear to you, probably 98, and that's kind of being generous, percent, all said, because that's just what you do. Like, the outliers were because mom and dad made me, because that's just what you do, because I can't get a job unless I do this. And there was never, like, I want to do this so I can become an engineer, so I can become heck, a better person. It was just all, we got to do this. It's like some mess we got to deal with so we can get out and live our lives. And I wanted to have a huge soliloquy about how wrong thinking that was, but I just sort of let, I was like, okay, next.
You're wasting a lot of money.
Yeah.
I was fortunate. When I went to college, I knew I was going to be a teacher, and I knew I was going to be a math teacher. So I had that, but you're right, even back then, and that's 20 some 30 years ago, there were so many kids there. Well, I'm taking my freshman classes because I really don't know what I want to do. Well, then why are you here?
Yes.
Go work for a while. Decide what you want to do. You can get a job. It doesn't have to be your career. There's the other thing. Bernie Sanders, you have to have $15 an hour at McDonald's. McDonald's is not a career.
No.
McDonald's is supposed to be what high schoolers do in the evening and the weekends to make some cash so they can, you know, buy some clothes or whatever. But he's like, no, it has to be $15 an hour because it's a living wage. No! I had to actually go to the counter at McDonald's last week and get my money back because they didn't give my order. I took my receipt up. I'm like, nobody's doing my order. And the manager looked at it and handed it back and then went back and started doing something else. And I'm like, what? And you want $15 an hour?
Yeah.
So it's just, but I think, again, that's the progressive. You have to dumb them down because you have to make them dependent on the state. That's the only way socialism works. And mm-hmm. that's all progressivism is, bringing socialism in. You give our kids the tools and the intelligence to be independent thinkers and do things on their own and be innovative. And they realize they don't need Bernie Sanders. They don't need Cory Booker. They don't need Barack Obama. They can do it on their own. They're more likely to say, get out of my face. And that's what progressives can't handle. They need you dependent on them.
Mm-hmm.
They need the state to be God.
That's what they're going for. It seems to be working.
And that is so frightening. That is a frightening thing of doing, because I've done many blogs on socialism and Hitler and Margaret Sanger and all of how that is all intertwined in there.
Mm-hmm.
And kids don't know this stuff. And you look at it and you say, okay, here's a perfect example. How many times have you heard people ask, how in the world did the Germans go along with the Nazis? Why did they sit around and let the Jews be taken? Have you watched what's going on social media? What happens when a conservative voice speaks out? What happens when a Hollywood personality comes out and says conservative things? They are destroyed to mm-hmm. the point that no one feels safe saying anything. Before you know it, the only voices that are allowed to be freely given are the extreme left.
Yeah.
That is exactly what happened in Germany. People were told when they went to go get a Jewish family, those soldiers looked over and you closed your blinds and you ignored what was happening, because if you tried to alarm and say, why are you taking that family? Mm-hmm. Guess who got taken too? So if you want to know how that happened, and the other mind-boggling thing about that is conservatives are called Nazis by the left.
Oh, yeah, it's the assault on the language. I just keep hammering this point every day where it's total inverse. It's whatever is right is wrong and is up is down. It's all complete adulteration of the language.
And so many people believe it, and it's like, do you even know what a Nazi is? You're calling me a Nazi. Do you even know what a Nazi is? Oh, my gosh. And then with the whole Margaret Sanger thing with that, too.
Yeah, I mean, we can get into some of this if you want to. I know you mentioned Woodrow Wilson.
Yep.
And we've talked to Alan Myers for the last few episodes, who's a CPA and forensic accountant, who's doing this great publication called Fed Ed, all about the Federal Reserve.
Oh, yeah.
So we've touched on Woodrow a little bit, but he was like, I always term him, he's like the Barack Obama of his day. He was totally destroying as much of America as possible. I think he did worse than Obama somehow, because he got the income tax, oh my gosh, there's so much more.
Well,
I'm blanking right now.
And I do that often too. He did so much damage to the progress that Republicans had made in race relations. We had torn, the Republicans had torn down so many walls as far as discrimination, and he built them right back up. Well, as I've written before, he brought the Jim Crow laws to a federal level. He started segregating the military. He started segregating the federal offices again. There were offices he's had where all the blacks just got let go. He was a huge risk. Oh, and he used W.E.B. Boys. Boys followed him and got a huge black population. That's kind of where the shift started, was at that time. And because time of the Civil, right after the Civil War till the very end of the 1800s, I don't think you could find a black person that was a Democrat. Maybe one. I mean, they were all Republicans. But he started segregating. The worst thing I did, he started rewriting the history. If you remember, he was a professor. He was also the president of, is it Harvard? Put my notes here. I think it was Harvard. Or Princeton, which one, I can't remember which one. He wrote The History of the American People.
Okay.
And it was incredibly racist. But there was a movie produced called Birth of a Nation.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
He premiered it in the White House, of course.
Premiered it in the White House. It's the first time a movie was ever shown. It was Birth of a Nation. This movie actually, because it was silent at the time, so I have a screenshot on some of my, where it has his quote talking about how great the KKK was.
Yeah.
How they saved the South from this horrible. Right there, he's starting with rewriting history. And from there, it's just gotten worse. And he was a despicable little man. I mean, he did so much damage to this country. And then FDR picked up after him. And then, like you said, Barack Obama just took it and made it so much worse.
He laid the groundwork. I was forgetting this. The 17th Amendment, that was his baby. And mm-hmm. then we got the Federal Reserve Act and then the income tax. And that was all for Woodrow. And not to mention the obvious racism and the legitimization of that through the film. And then, like you said, then we got the New Deal after that with FDR. And then mm-hmm. it just precipitated into LBJ's more handouts for not having fathers in the home.
My grandfather was a World War I veteran, and he had Purple Heart, two Silver Stars, and with World War I, our participation and everything in 1917 and 1918, I wrote several articles, blogs about battles and different things like that, because it's very close to my heart. My grandpa was very close to my heart. I never met him, but, oh, I adored him and what he did in the war. So I did write some about Pershing going over and how that all started, because my grandpa was part of the Big Red One, if you're familiar with the Big Red One, which was the first Americans going over. They were labeled the Big Red One, our first troops. Wilson refused to allow the blacks to fight with the whites. And at this point, they had been. There had been, because John J. Pershing, down with Teddy Roosevelt and San Juan Hill, they fought, the Rough Riders fought right next to the Buffalo Soldiers, if you're familiar.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So Pershing, who, you know, was our general in World War One, he was over it. And you've got Wilson telling him, no, the blacks aren't going to fight with us. They actually went in with French and English units because Wilson was so racist, he didn't even want them fighting next to each other, and it just set our race relations back so far. I mean, it wasn't until the 60s that we got things back to where they were before Wilson. And we could be so far more advanced in those relations if it hadn't been for him. And I'm sorry, Barack Obama took us back to the 1950s, if you ask me. What he did with his behind the scenes type of thing with the Black Lives Matter and all that, you can't tell me that he wasn't using them as Hitler used the brown shirt. If you're familiar. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I called them that during the time. They were Obama's little brown shirts. Because look at it now. How much do you hear about them now?
Very little.
Very little. Very little is going on. Things have gotten so much better because you don't have a president up there who is poking and prodding and doing that. And Wilson did that.
That's heavy. It's so hard for people to believe, I think, that he was this sort of real catalyst for really destroying everything on into the 50s and 60s, because most people have such a shallow memory. It's like, oh, the 60s and the civil rights riots and the 50s were people on the back of the bus and all this lynching and all this stuff, and it didn't have to be like that, I don't think.
No, to be honest with you, the KKK was virtually dead. It was on life support, if that, when Wilson entered the White House. Premiering Birth of a Nation and his support of that actually revived the KKK. And not only in the South, it was shown in the North, where the North didn't have those feelings against blacks. But because of that movie, it incited violence against blacks in the North. It made it worse than it was even during the Civil War, because you had now you had the North participating. They would run down and beat down blacks outside the movie theater because they would be so enraged by what that movie, and it was a pack of lies.
Mm-hmm.
Pack of lies. Again, it was because of that movie the KKK was revived, and we had to deal with all of that through the 50s and 60s. We wouldn't have had the KKK if it hadn't been for Wilson, or we wouldn't have had it revived if it hadn't been for Wilson. We wouldn't have had to deal with all of that in the first half of the 19th century.
And then you had this huge revitalization after that. The late 40s and 50s was this huge, we had all these different people in office, like Senator Byrd, Hillary Clinton's muse that she gave a eulogy for. Oh, he's the greatest grand cyclops of all, I guess, according to Hillary.
Yes, but, he was. And I don't see, they get passes. Why do they get passes?
I don't get it.
And Republicans are forced out of office for something they did when they were 19. And then you've got Byrd. It is so infuriating because it's, you know, the media is, the worst part is the media. If we had a true, honest media, the way that it should be, the way that it was set up to be, they're supposed to be the watchdog of the government. Oh, okay, Wilson. How did the media get so cozy with the government?
Yeah.
Guess who started those dinners where the president would go with all the, we just had it, what was it called? What's it called? The correspondence dinners?
Okay, gotcha.
Guess who started that? Wilson.
Gotta be Wilson, yeah.
Get cozy with the media, and they would be friendly to him. He was such an evil man. Such an evil man.
I think that's what really fanned the flames during the Obama regime, was all the media just sort of pushing this divisive race mess all the time. I'm a sucker for basketball, so I still watch it a little bit. And I would just watch it, and I got to where I had to cut it off because, I mean, they would be infusing this into the basketball game. I'm like, it's a basketball game. Why are we doing the hands up, don't shoot mess? And why are we pushing this Black Lives Matter mess? It's a basketball game. Why, if you want to do that, go over there. Like, it's a basketball.
Exactly, exactly. And again, that's the whole progressive thing. You have to break the entire culture. What did Michelle Obama said?
Oh, yeah.
We have to rewrite our history and erase our culture and everything. They're doing it.
They are.
And we're allowing them. And again, and that's why I write what I write. Because I am not going to let, at least for my daughter, and I told my daughter, I said, you know, it's not going to be necessarily me. It's going to be you. It's going to be you that's out there that is tooting the horn and speaking the truth. So I literally am writing them for her. But again, I want everybody that wants to benefit from them to benefit from them, because I talk about this. I will talk about an event, and at the end, I'll relate it to something that's going on now, and it's just history repeating, and or as Mark Twain said, if it doesn't repeat, but it sure does rhyme. So, and it's the other thing with it is I've been writing for 5 years, so you can actually go back and, because I'll write of what happened at that time, I'll write about what Barack said, or, you know, back when in his, they're almost their own history book as far as that. Because you can go back and, what happened in 2016? Well, you can she can read these and go, oh, that's what was happening. That's what was being said. That's what was being done. So they're history books being written of today's history, which, as you know, the media is rewriting it right now. So somebody's got to write down what the truth is on it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to add. That's a great move, because it probably won't be up in a few years.
Yeah, and that's another reason why I print them every year and make books of them. So if nothing else, I at least have a printed copy, because who knows when the whole thing's going to crash and they're going to take a lot of the stuff down.
I mean, for my money, that's why they're putting everything on the cloud and on the servers and all this now, because then like, they can just, oh, let's just take that down. We don't need to know about what happened. Black Lives Matter. Was irrelevant.
Exactly, exactly. They're cherry-picking it already. Some of the articles that I have put on the fax paper, which that's the other part of the fax paper. It has my blog, but it also has, let's say you want to find out what, okay, I keep hearing all this about abortion from like the plan, the pro-choice. What are the pro-life people saying? I'll put articles on there that you can go research and see what's happening. I've got articles on there. Hey, science shows that the heart's beating at, you know, 5 weeks or whatever it is. I've gone back periodically and looked through, and some of those articles, the links are gone. So I don't know why on many cases, but who knows? Are they going to systematically take this stuff down? So that's kind of why I try to print it when I can.
For people that don't know about Margaret Sanger, which I hope is no one, but, again, connecting dots through the Woodrow Wilson, the rise of increased racism, you can't even talk about that without throwing Margaret out there, because she was just pushing this eugenics agenda, which I always go back to those anthropology stuff, which was predicated on the Darwinian, on the origin of species by means of natural selection, or the favored races, that little subtitle they always try to leave out of his publication, for the favored races. So there's a connection there.
Oh, there is a huge connection there, because everybody wants to think that Hitler was the one who brought all this in.
Mm-hmm.
Hitler learned from us.
Yeah, he was pen pals with Mark. He was writing letters going, you're doing a great job. I wish I could get this off the ground so I could start killing too.
He learned about the gas chamber from George Bernard Shaw. It was American eugenics, especially those out in California, that were giving him the ideas. He writes about it in Mein Kampf. So here's a quote from Margaret that I had jotted down from, she had her own publication, Birth Control Review, in 1921. The undeniably feeble-minded should indeed not only be discouraged, but prevented from propagating their kind. Birth control was intended, quote, to create a race of thoroughbreds and must lead ultimately to a cleaner race. I wrote down she referred to blacks, immigrants and the poor as human weeds and reckless breeders, and insisted that we are failing to segregate morons who are increasing and multiplying a dead weight of human waste and ever-increasing spawning class of human beings who never should have been born at all. She pushed all this. They went, oh, Planned Parenthood is for women's health.
Oh, yeah.
Bull. It was all about getting... Why do you think Planned Parenthood offices are in the poorest neighborhoods? Poor and black. Get rid of the ones that can't take care of themselves that are going to infect the master race.
That's what I was drawing parallels as you were talking. I was thinking, where have I heard that before?
Didn't this
guy at Austria say something similar?
Exactly. Don't think Hitler came up with that baby on his own. And in fact, when his stuff started coming out, we didn't understand what he was honestly doing to the Jews or as far as his experiments until after the war was over and we got in there and started seeing what was happening. Once the truth started coming out and people started hearing what Hitler was doing with eugenics and how he was playing with all that, that's when Margaret started changing her tune and her focus. Because it wasn't that she was embarrassed by it. It's she didn't want any bad publicity as to what she was doing. She had to rebrand it.
You took the words right out of my brain. She was using the Edward Bernays tactics. She was just rebranding.
And they went. They started passing laws. The eugenicists and the progressives, they started passing laws. I don't know how many people know this. There was forced sterilization in the Americas until the 1980s.
Absolutely.
And they targeted the blacks, the Latinos, the poors, and the Native Americans. Mm-hmm. Forced sterilization. She has in one of her books this whole list. She basically wanted you to go and apply to be able to have a baby like you would apply to go for a dog's license. This is Margaret Sanger. And don't say, oh, well, maybe that's who she was, but that's not who Planned Parenthood is now. Bull. There are more.
They just changed the name.
There are more black babies aborted in New York City than there are born alive. Don't tell me they are not following the Margaret Sanger platform. This is all racism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about getting rid of who they think is not good enough. Which is kind of funny because there's now a huge assault on the white population. So who's at this point? I mean, progressives are going against white, but wait a minute. Your whole history is going against the non-master race, the non-white race. So, they're contradicting themselves. I think the time-space continuum is about to explode because they're going against themselves.
I've heard people sort of throw that out there in conversation, too. There needs to be a license to have children, because look at all these crazy people everywhere. And on the one hand, I'm like, I get you. But the caveat is, who's going to be the one deciding? And just like with all things communists, they're going to be the one deciding. So just like with the Margaret Sanger garbage, she was going to be the one deciding who is a weed and who isn't a weed, who's going to get her licensure or not. Who's going to get the food? Who's not? Who's going to get to go to the good school? Who's not? I mean, it's always this dichotomy, this satanic Hunger Games, like a global feudalism scenario. I think all these movies are just a rollout for what they really want to push, because it's like, oh, yeah, you'll just live in the sewer while there will be this fraction of 1% that lives in a huge castle on the hill, and they'll just hunt you or kill you or whatever.
Exactly, exactly. You're right. It's all comes down to who has control over it. You've got the same thing with the censorship on the internet. Okay, who's going to determine what is hate speech? But it is. It's, and so many people don't understand who Margaret Sanger is, what the whole, and they try to dismiss it. They do. They try to dismiss it. Even if they acknowledge it, like I'd said before, well, Margaret may have been that way, but that's not who Planned Parenthood is. Hmm. Well, go try to get a mammogram from Planned Parenthood. You can't. That is a lie. That is a lie that you can get these things. It is all about, yes, you can go get birth control. Yes, you can go get condoms. Yes, you can go get some of these simple things. But it's 83% of their income is brought in by abortions. And then they turn around and sell the baby parts. If you did you see Unplanned?
I haven't. It's on my things to do list. But
it's on my things to do as well. But I did see an interview with Abby Johnson,
mm-hmm.
and who was the inspiration of all that, if you recall.
Yeah, I would love to talk to her.
Oh, she is a fascinating interview. But she came out and said, the goal of Planned Parenthood is for a woman to get 3 abortions by the time she's 30. One while she's in high school, one while she's in her 20s, or one while she's in college, and then one while she's in her 20s. Why would you do that? Because they sell the parts. And you're breaking down the culture.
Yeah. Not to mention you're upping that woman's risk of all kinds of cancer. They don't even throw that caveat out there. It's always like, oh, it'll be fine. It's painless. You go in and out. It's like getting a blood draw.
There are so many women that suffer traumatic, I don't know if I would call it PTSD, but they have that traumatic experience afterwards, because lots of times, what did I just do? Yeah. And if they were honestly given the truth, and that's why Planned Parenthood fights these laws with the sonograms, because if they were given the truth, most women actually will end up choosing life. If they're shown the sonogram or they understand that it is a human life, they understand that that is a heartbeat. That's why they're fighting against the heartbeat bill. Don't call it a heartbeat. Well, what else is it? You know, a drum beat? You know, what? I mean, I remember the first time I heard my daughter's heartbeat, and it's an experience you just don't forget. And I'm sure if you were in there that is just, and for a woman, it never was, oh, that's just my body and they're making noise. No, it's not your belly growling because you're hungry.
Exactly.
It's a completely separate entity. It has its own DNA. It's got its own brain, it's got its own spinal cord, it's got its own blood type, it's got its own heartbeat and lungs.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, very tiny at the beginning, but it grows very, very fast. And all these things develop by weeks, sometimes before you even know you're pregnant. And we are lying to our children about it. We call people climate science deniers if they don't believe in climate change, but if you want to look at a baby as being a baby, it's okay to deny that. You can deny that science, but you can't deny these models that can be manipulated on the climate. It's, again, it's just this whole
thing. Yeah, the language thing is just insane. They always throw these bizarre, well, they're not bizarre, but they throw these terms on there, like the conspiracy term or a truther or a denier. They always throw these sort of terms out there to marginalize those people. So it's like, just get in line. Get in line with the sheep or else we're going to call you a name. You're going to be a denier or a truther or a conspiracy theorist. Follow the herd off the cliff.
They're masters at controlling the language. And that's why we have issues sometimes with some of these arguments, because they end up controlling the language. We have to take that language back. We have to be the ones also fighting back with that and saying, no, that's not the way it is.
Yeah, I'm surprised they haven't come out with, like, a baby truther yet. You must be one of those baby truthers. You believe in children.
Oh, don't give them any ideas.
Yeah, I'm really glad you hit on the Sanger stuff, because that's really a key principle that nobody seems to know. Nobody knows about her and Hitler being pen pals, the birth control league.
She was over in Germany for several years and studying over there, because all this progressivism started in Germany before the turn of the century, and that's where a lot of them learned. So by the time they were adults in the 1920s and whatever, this was in them, and it's that whole socialism. And yes, the pretty little word progressive, all it means is we're progressing to socialism slowly.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to do what Hitler did. We're going to progress slowly. We're going to take away the family. We're going to put the woman the whole thing about putting the woman into the workforce. That's all about breaking down the family unit.
So the state can be the parents. That's it.
Yes.
And it's all the Frankfurt School out of Frankfurt, Germany, mm-hmm. that really got infused in, the 50s, 60s, and so forth with the Frankfurt School primarily predicated on relativism. Everything's relative. So you mm-hmm. can do whatever you want. You might identify as a man. You might identify as a pork chop. It's all okay. It's all relative.
Oh, yeah, that whole identifying stuff is just really insane.
Yeah.
And it is damaging our children. It is damaging our children beyond repair. But look at what's happening, John. Okay, we're going to convince these kids, as teenagers, we're going to allow them to decide that they are the opposite sex. We're going to give them hormones and sometimes do the surgery. What does that do to the body?
Yeah, sterilizes
them.
Yeah.
They don't give a rat's rear end what you identify as.
Yeah, they want you sterilized.
They want you sterilized.
And a lot of that, I know in North Carolina, it was one of those states that you were talking about that had the forced sterilization. There's I won't say it's a rich history, but it's a history they don't want you to know about for the birth control league and the sterilization laws. And they had these sort of things at fairs. I know you've probably seen this stuff too if you look at the history of it, where you basically go to the fair and they'll tell you your heritage and your lineage. And from that, they can sort of, they're going, okay, well, Bob's a moron, so that means we're going to have to take him out of the game.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I look at these parallels, kind of like you were saying, where everyone's doing this, 21 and Me is one of them, but there's all these different, just send in your DNA and pay $100 and they'll tell you what you got. And now it was in the news not too long ago, and I was like, is nobody thinking about, is everybody that stupid that they're selling that DNA? They're collecting and harvesting your DNA? No joke. Of course they are.
Yeah, I had some family members do that for me because, as you know, I'm a genealogist, and, you know, I was trying to do the limit, and it isn't. Fascinating. I mean, when it's not used, it is fascinating. I've actually been able to connect a couple people who've contacted me and said, hey, my mother was adopted, or my dad was adopted, or I was adopted, and I'm getting hits to this person or that person. And I've been able to find out who their birth parents were that were in my family.
Nice.
And them. So, I mean, it is fascinating.
Yeah.
You can do stuff like that, but yes, in the past couple of years, it's been, because it's been quite a while since, you know, they've done that.
Sure.
And it's one of those things you're going, oh, should I have had them do that?
Yeah.
Because now it's, what's going to happen? That you're right. Can they sell? They are selling that stuff, and it's kind of out there now. And
yeah.
And it's, this is why the founders wanted a small government, because when you get big, you just want to get bigger. It's mm-hmm. it's a beast you can't satisfy. You have to keep feeding it. I mean, it's like a drug addict. They take that first hit and it's great, and then you take the next one, but it's not as good. So you have to do more. And you have to keep doing more. Well, that's what the government is. They keep needing their hits.
Yeah.
And they're not going to get satisfied unless we, you know, do an intervention and cut them off. So,
yeah, I'm thinking Margaret Sanger and Hitler would be super excited about these these genetic websites, because they could be like, oh, great, now we got the dossier. Now we could just go over there to Mr. Jenkins' house and snuff him out, because we know he's X, Y, and Z. So
that brings up something incredibly scary I read the other day. De Blasio, we can put whatever we want in those vaccines.
Yeah.
We can put whatever we want to in your body. And you can't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
Has anybody ever wondered why so many people can't have kids? My sisters couldn't get pregnant. My cousin couldn't get pregnant. A very good friend of mine couldn't get pregnant. Why are all these people unable to get pregnant? Are they actually putting something in those vaccines? And I'm back and forth. I'm not going to mm-hmm. make any judgments on, you know, whether you should vaccinate your children or not. It's, but I am very concerned that they have the ability to do that. They have the opportunity to do that.
Yeah.
And it's very scary because we don't know what they're doing. So, and you're right. Hey, I see what their DNA is. Yeah, give them the special vaccination.
Well, of course. I mean, they already have race-specific bioweapons that they can release and just target a specific ethnicity. And I mean, we know Bill Gates and what he's got going on in Africa, where he's pushing these vaccines that have exactly what you said. They have different elements that'll basically say, okay, we'll spontaneously abort the child at, I don't know, I'm making this up because I'm not reading it in front of me, like 3 months or 6 weeks or what have you. And it's all in the vaccines. And we know who Bill Gates' father was. He was the head of Planned Parenthood. Connected all those dots like you were talking about. I mean, that's just...
Puzzle pieces just keep...
Yeah, they keep on connecting.
And again, this is why it is so important to learn this history. Because you... Look, we're talking and we're going, warning sign, warning sign, warning sign. How many people don't know it? They innocently don't understand what is happening because they have not purposely, they have purposely mm-hmm. not been giving the warning signs. And that's why it's just, I'm out there trying to, I'm a teacher. I'm trying to help educate to get the word out there and to show people that, yeah, we need to know what's going on because you need to start stepping up and saying, no, government, you're way over bounds here.
That would be nice.
Mm-hmm.
I get so frustrated because they treat all these politicians and they give them this whole red carpet deal. And I'm like, they're working for you. No, they work for you.
What's really funny is I've been, I do a lot on the Revolutionary War as well, different battles and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And read about how Parliament is just so arrogant and King George is just so arrogant in his, no, we own you. You are our subjects. And I'm going, how is Washington today any different? They have decided that they are now a noble class. How many times do we see these politicians' children getting into politics?
Yes.
What's nobility? Nobility is just, it just goes down the heritage. But you were in the different classes and nobody could break through.
Mm-hmm.
Why do they hate Trump? Because he wasn't a political family. He broke through. He literally was an outsider.
Yeah.
That's why they hate him. How difficult is it for a lot of people to get into Congress who don't have any, they're just an average Joe. It's very difficult. We are setting up our own nobility here. It's like, hey, no, we fought that war 200 plus years ago. For a reason. We don't need it to come here now. So, but you're right. Yeah, the red carpet and the all the little perks they get, and they're voting themselves pay raises, or we don't have to comply with Obamacare, but everybody else does.
That's what's so silly. I feel like it's the same stuff we were talking about. It's just rebranding. Like, we're not going to call it a monarchy. We're just going to have George in there, and then George Bush again, the Bush crime family, and then we'll have the Clinton crime family run for a little while, and then...
Well, now they want Michelle Obama in there.
Yeah, then... Yeah.
No!
But it's not a monarchy, because we're going to call it a presidency, so...
Yes, yes. And the purpose was to get different blood, different ideas, different concepts, because you don't want it consolidated power. And that's what the monarchy is, consolidated power. Not that the monarchy in England has any power anymore, but they're kind of figureheads.
I mean, we could go on a total rabbit hole on this one, but I know you remember the girl, I think it was like a high school kid or something during the first Obama regime, and she was doing the genetics of all the presidents and found that they were all basically related, except mm-hmm. for one or two.
Mm-hmm.
And that rang bells with me looking at the eugenics connections, because the Galtons, the Wedgwoods, and the Darwins, they were all intermarrying in England and trying to create, again, not a master race, but a master race.
Yes. Well, and what happens when you inbreed too much, John?
Yeah, that's it. Darwin married his cousin, and they had a few problems.
Yes. Yes. So that's why you're supposed to not regulate that.
And, yeah.
Oh. Bring up another thing that equates with the eugenics of Margaret Sanger. Marriage certificates. Why did they start doing marriage certificates?
I know. That's a very important one. I'm glad you got on that one.
Back in Civil War time, even before Civil War, blacks could marry, but they had to have permission. They could even be, you know, my owner's owner A, your owner B, but if the owners allowed, they could marry.
Hmm.
That was okay. Once the Civil War ended slavery, laws were passed that blacks could not marry whites. Then it became, well, if you get permission from the state, we'll let you do it. So you didn't used to have a marriage certificate. It was through the church, and lots of times it was even, you know, just kind of an agreement with the family. The state should not be involved here. But when it got into the turn of the century in the 1900s with eugenics, do you remember that you used to have blood tests?
Oh, yeah.
Why? Because they wanted to check and see, did you have diseases? Was there any reason you shouldn't be able to procreate?
Mm-hmm.
It was all trying to fill in this master race, and they would deny you a marriage license if they didn't think you should be out there having kids. So it's just this whole progressive, just their fingers in everything. And nowadays people are like, well, yeah, you need to go get a marriage license. Why? Why does the government have any business in that?
That was my take when they were coming out with the gay marriage thing, and I was thinking, hey, the government shouldn't be telling anybody what to do.
Yeah.
That should be a church thing.
Yes, exactly. And if some churches want to marry same sex, they have the right to do it. If this church doesn't want to, then this church has the right to do it.
Exactly.
The government should not be in it at all. Now, from a constitutional standpoint as well, it should never be at the federal level anyway. Mm-hmm. That is a state's rights issue. But they took it out of the federal judges, took it out of the hands, and it went to, you know, Supreme Court, and it became a federal thing. I'm sorry. That was an absolute abhorrent ruling because it is a state's issue. Each state has the right to determine how that goes. If California wants to have it, let California have it. Let the people vote on it. And that, if you recall, that's how it started. They had Proposition, I think, was it 8?
I think so.
California's voted it down. They didn't want it. But they took it to a judge. And an activist judge pushed it away up to the Supreme Court. I mean, about rabbit holes. Go down the judicial rabbit hole. How we've got the activists in. You judge shop now.
Yeah. Which I don't understand any of that. So many of the things that are problematic in the country should, again, be a states' rights thing. Like, almost everything that comes up, and I'm like, why is this a federal issue?
Abortion,
it's a states' issue.
Abortion is a states' issue.
Yeah.
Article 9 of the Bill of Rights, anything that is not specifically addressed in the Constitution goes back to the states, and the states determine. And we have lost that. And that's, you know, hey, you want a good segue?
Sure.
Progressives are trying to do with the Electoral College and the popular vote.
Good.
They're trying to take down all the borders between the states. They don't want us to be different states anymore. They want us to be one entity. Well, we're not. We're 50 separate states. And they're trying to break that down. They don't want different states having different laws or different ideas. They want us all under their little progressive bubble,
mm-hmm.
being controlled by the federal government.
That's what's such a terrifying prospect to me for this whole 2020 thing, because so many people are like, oh, it's a foregone deal. And I'm like, no, it's really not. Like, these communist fruitcakes have already allowed post-term abortions in New York. And for what I was reading the other day, in Illinois, they're about to pass something even worse than what was going on in New York. And I was like, how the heck can that be possible? But apparently they're, you know.
They keep the tube when you decide that you don't want the child anymore.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's kind of what I'm thinking with the Electoral College. All they have to do is get rid of that, and we're into a complete gloves-off, mask-off totalitarian regime for eternity, I guess.
What's really interesting is my pinned tweet right now on Twitter is about this Electoral College, and I said, you know, if we eliminate the Electoral College, it's over. And I had so many people come back, this is unconstitutional, this will never happen. And I had to respond to him, you got to look at what's really happening. Yes, the Electoral College is constitutional, but look at how they're trying to circumvent it. Mm-hmm. They're trying to go around it by passing laws that says, we don't give a rat's rear end what our people vote for in our state. We're going to go with the popular vote and give our electoral votes this way. Now, again, people all come back, that's unconstitutional. Actually, it's not. The states have the right to determine how their electoral votes are given. They have that right. That's why some states, if you see the map on election night, there's actually some states where this person gets 10 votes and this person gets 3. And you're like, well, how do they get separate? Isn't it all or they're not all or all or nothing? Okay. When the country first started, some states like New York, their legislators actually determined who got the elected. The people didn't even have a vote. They elected their legislators. We're a republic, remember? And their legislators said, we're giving our 3, 4, 5 electoral votes to this person or that person. So the people of New York didn't even have a vote in the first couple presidential elections.
Jeez.
So what they're trying to do is just circumvent that. So it really needs to be the people standing up. And in fact, Colorado, they passed the law back in March, and almost that day or the day after, they started a repeal of it. People have got to understand what the progressives are doing, what the liberals are doing at their state levels, because they're trying to pass these laws. I think 18 states have passed them now. And if they get enough states to pass these laws that equal 270 electoral votes, then their laws all go into effect. So on election night, you can have the board looking one way, and then they put this law into effect, and it is a completely different election. People in the states have got to know what their legislators are doing, and they need to be standing up and fighting back. And because what they're doing is they're taking your voice away. I'm in Ohio. Ohio, you know, is a purple state. It is a swing state.
Mm-hmm.
So we voted for Donald Trump last election. Let's say we vote for Donald Trump this election again. But the popular vote happens to go to whoever insane Democrat. You're going to take my vote away? You're going to silence my voice? Again, they're trying to cut down the borders. The founders were so incredibly brilliant when they put the Electoral College together because they understood New York has different values than Nebraska.
Uh-huh.
Florida has different values than Wisconsin. They have different, and they're going to have different populations. And the Democrat argument is, well, we need to go the popular vote so everybody's vote counts. Well, then that should be, then all states should have the same electoral vote. They took into account population. They also took into account that they don't want New York, just because New York has more people, shouldn't be telling Iowa what to do. So that's why they have the Electoral College, because it gives Iowa a voice. If we lose the concept of the Electoral College and just do the popular vote, where are the presidential candidates going to go to campaign? Do you think they're going to go to Iowa anymore?
That's a
big deal. Everybody goes to Iowa. You have to go to Iowa. Iowa's not going to mean anything anymore. You go to New York, you go to Chicago, you go to Miami, you go to Houston, and you go to California.
That's it.
That's it. Maybe Ohio. Seriously, because it is a big, it does have 23 electoral college.
Yeah.
But your flyover country is that flyover. You are going to be dictated to by New York, by the coastline. The coastline is going to tell you how to live. And that's what's so scary about it, because I do get all these responses. It's unconstitutional. And so they say that, so I'm not going to worry about it. Well, how many things are unconstitutional that are going on in this country because nobody stands up and says no?
Yes, exactly. That would be my point to the whole thing. I don't know how many articles a bleeping day I read where it's like, well, they're taking this guy's guns in Maryland because of this new gun law. They just took this child because they didn't give it chemo or vaccines in Arizona and on and on, even to Obamacare. And I'm going, and the people stood up. Nope. All right. And we're on to the next day's news, and it's the same cycle of insanity.
And again, it's because look at where most people are getting their news from. And it's why conservative voices on social media and in other places are being silenced, because you can't let this truth get out. Because if the truth gets out, people are going to fight back.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to silence it. You can't let it get out there. So
I hate to even add this to the mix, but I know if that happens, when the president, basically his likelihood or her likelihood of being elected is going to be predicated on by 5-6 states, then the rest of the states probably aren't going to get that much love. So if there's a tornado in Nebraska, sure, the president is benevolent and all loving, and he's going to swoop down with all this federal funding, or not. He might just say, hey, let's just focus on L.A., Texas, yeah, Florida, and Atlanta, or what have you, you know.
Exactly. And it's just, it would be such a detriment to how great this country is, because we rely on those people. There are farmers, there are, you know, industry workers, and they will, it's like Ocasio-Cortez. She made the video. She didn't even know what a garbage disposal is. Now, I'm going to give her a little bit of the benefit of the doubt, because apparently where she grew up in the Bronx, they weren't allowed, okay? So she didn't know what it was, which is case in point.
That's a communist bleephole of New York. So.
Yes, middle America is laughing at her because she doesn't know what it is. And she wants to tell us how we are supposed to live, when she doesn't even know what a garbage disposal is. You have to take it into that context, because if we so willingly give up our rights and our, just give it up to the government like that and say, okay, you just take care of it, you are getting the coast. And we all know how bad the coasts are. Hollywood's falling apart.
Yeah.
LA is falling apart. People are crapping on the streets in San Francisco. New York is no better. The other problem with doing this, and why the Electoral College is so brilliant, is it cuts down on voter fraud. Because if you're dealing with just precincts or a state, yeah, you might be able to do something in one state, but you've got all these other, you can't do that in every state. You can't do
yeah.
But if you're just popular vote, sanctuary cities, you give the illegals the ability to vote, they go in, you tell them who to vote for. So it doesn't matter. When you have the Electoral College, New York would be confined to the electoral votes they have, no matter how many votes they get. So they can get as many illegal votes as they want. They're still confined to their Electoral College. But if you allow them the popular vote, then all those illegal votes do make a difference. And that's where a huge problem is.
Okay. I hate to say wow, but wow.
Yeah.
I'm going to get started on my We Are Doomed front and back sandwich sign.
You and I can stand out there with our little sandwich.
Yeah. That'll be the new merchandise on the site. I'll just have that instead of a site promo sticker or anything. It'll just be that.
I know. So, yeah, we've got a big uphill battle, but as I've told many people, for my daughter's sake, I'm not going to stop fighting.
I'm right there in the same boat with you. I mean, you can't.
Can't.
Like I was telling another guest, when you first hold that child, you realize, okay, I really can't foul this up. Not only for me, I can't screw it up for her. So.
I know, exactly. It completely changes your perspective, which is really sad because so many people don't truly – we've taken away that understanding of how precious life is.
Mm-hmm.
With abortion, it's, oh, I don't want this one.
Yeah.
And no, that is a life. That is a precious life. Another interesting thing that I've seen is a couple people talk about is a good argument to say to an abortionist is, okay, you want climate change to be fixed. You might be aborting that scientist to fix climate change.
Yeah.
You might be aborting the doctor that cures cancer. You know, it's we don't know what that life is in there. And I have two adopted nieces. Both of them do have some issues, but I'd rather be dealing with that than not dealing with them. You know, with them have not been here. I glorify their parents, their mothers, for making that decision to go ahead and have the child. And it is a tough decision. We need to make adoption laws so much easier. It's $50,000, $60,000 to adopt a child in this country. That's insane. It is insane.
I didn't even know that.
Yeah. It's incredible. My sister had to take out a loan to adopt her children. The first one. So it's just... The second was an open adoption thing, and she only had to pay legal fees. And that's the way it should be. We should be doing more like that because it was reasonable. And she was able to take the daughter from the hospital. And she has a connection with the mother. So, and you can work that out as parents, whether you want to do that or not. But one of the abortionist argument is, well, who's going to adopt it? Well, if you made it easier, I can give you a list of 1,000 people that would take that child right now.
Absolutely.
There are so many loving people in this country and ones who can't have kids for whatever reason. They would love to adopt. I have so many friends that are just heartbroken because they never had kids. And if it would have been easier to adopt, they'd probably have 3 or 4.
Wow. Well, where can we find everything Pamela Adams? Because I want people to actually get on this blog and get these books. I'm going to start reading my own daughter these. These sound great.
I hope you do. They're just fascinating. They're links to other articles I've written. It's at the Facts Paper, F-A-C-T-S, factspaper.com. My blog's on there. The latest one is always at the top, and then you can go to the archives to find any of the other ones and search for them. I also have articles on there. A lot of things I've talked about, the Electoral College, Margaret Sanger, all these things. I have links also to different subjects, abortion, Second Amendment, all these. If you want to find out some information about the pro-life or the pro-gun or just so you have arguments, there's articles there that you can refer to that have facts about these issues that you're not going to get the mainstream media, that they don't want you to see. So, and I'm constantly updating it as new things come out, new articles come out.
And they can get the books there too, right?
There's a bookstore there, all my books. I have 5 Liberating Letter volumes there. I also did write one book. I worked with another person. We talked earlier about the genealogy and what was going on. He contacted me, and he wanted to do just that. So we went through 7 generations of his family, and I put with it what was going on in the country at that time. So it may not be your family, but you can see what families were doing at that time. So I've got that book on there, and I also have 3 genealogy books if you are a genealogist. And we might have similar ancestors from areas. I've got my genealogy books on there as well.
Nice. I like it.
I do also have a Patreon page if you want to help support, because right now I'm doing this all on my own. I support everything on my own. Have you heard of Patreon?
Oh, yeah. I need to get on there. I'm not, which I should be, but...
I have a Patreon page in there, so if you want to help support my efforts and help me get resources so I can research more true history and not what's being shoved down our poor children's throats, you can sponsor me on Patreon and earn some free books.
That sounds terrific. Well, if anybody missed all that, fear not. You can check out AnomicAge.com and find everything Pamela Adams. The video for the show, the audio for the show, all the guest links, and you can absolutely check out her own site and check out her Patreon and books, for love of Pete. Do it. If you stick around for a second, I'll wrap things up here, and we'll talk for a moment, if that's all right.
That's fine.
All right, thank you all for joining us today on the Anomic Age. I hope you all got a wealth of information from our guest, Pamela Adams. Remember, you can't do everything, but you can absolutely do something, so please get out there and try to make your own difference, make your own small part in someone's life, if nothing else. Until next time, we'll be seeing you.
Thank you for listening to The Anomic Age, a John Age project. For past shows, further info, and to comment, go to AnomicAge.com. That's AnomicAge.com. Till next time, thank you for listening to The Anomic Age. I'm going to go to the next one.